FM, WRAF, and HAP presents Jump Time Michigan. We know time to top, so the Rosell Meltdown is hitting the streets with a ton of great freebies, drumming up some excitement for local Michigan businesses.
Get all the info on where we'll be this week at WRAF.com.
Then, join Meltdown broadcasting live tomorrow from 3 to 7 at Buck Whalen Chevrolet on Van Dyke and Sterling Heights with free food from Zentino's, the Eastside's newest hotspot, and home for WRAF's Monday Night Pigskin Playoff Party. The first 25 customers will join us and get a free family fun pack from Blake Silchers and Cider Mill, including cider, donuts, pie, and caramel apples. Plus, register to win passes to the screening of Creed Live DVD November 19th. Jumpstart Michigan, brought to you by HAP.
Ranked highest in member satisfaction among commercial health plans in Michigan. For J.D. Power and Associates award information, visit jdpower.com.
And 101 WRIF, the road.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
All right, Mr. Announcer, thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Julene Jordan, happy Sunday.
And well, thank you.
All that to you. How
yes.
are you doing?
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, well, you know, I was thinking, we're lucky this is actually public affairs programming, because I think if we were really, like, fighting for the ratings, we
right.
would lead with lots of other things, you know.
Yeah, like, things, more sensationalistic things.
Well, that's one thing, like Carrie Prejean's sex tapes. No longer sex tape.
There's eight of them.
Yeah, wait a minute, man. We don't want to talk about that. Or at least like healthcare, Afghanistan. You know, they're going to have the trial of these 9/11
yeah.
guys in the United States. But we've got to work with something here, at least as far as I'm concerned, that's a little more, all of them are important except for Carrie Prejean's sex tapes. That's not very important, but it's great fun. We will talk about that. But it's our old friend class war. And as usual, folks, we're losing. That is, the we is the middle class and the working class, and the poor always loses. But let me just read an email. I rarely do this. This is from, let me see, did he, which, this is from Rick. Maybe Rick from East Point, but I could be wrong. I must have not taken the second page. Here he says, and he wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, where you can send email as well. He says, what I resent is having money I earn taken from me to pay for someone else's housing, health care, utilities, cell phone, bridge card, etc. It's my money. What right does the government have redistributing it?
Well, we've heard this one.
Yeah.
Many
now,
times.
Redistributing it. I mean, so what happens? I mean, it's always a matter of redistribution. In fact, that's what taxes do. They take money from us, and then they redistribute it to, well, I mean, sometimes it goes to poor people's what's called bridge cards here in the United States. But I rarely write long responses. Sometimes I do, though. So I wrote back to Rick. I said, so you qualify for the party of resentment. But I said, it's understandable, given how low our salaries are compared to the wealth we produce and what low return we get for our taxes. So, I mean, people are concerned. You pay taxes, what do we get back? We got crappy roads, crappy schools,
right.
You know, it all goes to the banksters, right?
Yeah.
And I wrote, the U.S. actually has one of the lowest tax rates in the industrialized world, and yet people in other countries with higher tax rates don't usually complain because they get a lot back, like for instance, full health care and
yeah,
things like
right.
that.
Sure.
But I say, what you complain about is mean-spirited and misses the mark. Our money is being redistributed to the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, the agribusiness-industrial complex, and all the other giant complexes that loot the wealth that we produce.
All
what
true.
What the poor get is a pittance, but I said, Rick, you pick on them as getting our money. Wrong target, I'd say.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Plus, without redistribution of wealth, you'd soon have feudalism back with the elite ruling us more than they do today. Anyway, what are you saying? Screw the unfortunate? If so, don't be so certain you couldn't wind up to be one of them. Any of us could.
That's right.
Now, that's, I don't know, what you say, maybe sort of a debatable deal. But, you know, we are in the crosshairs of the warriors for the ultra wealthy in this class warfare. They don't even, I wouldn't even say the crosshairs, because that sort of suggests guerrilla warfare. They're involved in frontal oppositional warfare, like what happened during World War II or World War I, except we're barely a tiny guerrilla unit. Insurgents.
Right.
When they had a good name instead of a bad name.
Right.
Right? Because, like, you know, the Yugoslav partisans fighting against the Nazis, or some of the resistance by Jewish guerrilla groups and, mm-hmm. and what have you. But so they're involved in frontal positional warfare against the middle class, against the working class. Like I said, the poor always get screwed, so we don't need to talk about that. But here. Here's what I'm talking about. Here's what I think is so important. And by the way, if you want to phone us up, it's 313-298-WRIF. And you can either comment on whatever's going on in the world other than what I'm talking about, or respond to this as well. This was hidden away. I mean, I get the New York Times every day. That's one of the ways I prepare for this broadcast. The reason I get the New York Times is because it informs the upper classes. It's got liberal social policy, you know, the conservatives. It's a liberal paper. Yeah, but it's written for financiers. It's written for the banksters. So it gives you all the financial news. It gives you in-depth political news, a lot of times just filled, you know, with the same crap that lesser publications have, mm-hmm. and distortions and lies and what have you. But they want their people. They're not about fooling. I mean, a lot of what media is about fooling people. They don't want to fool their readership, although they have, you know, like the run-up to the Iraq War and all that. They were big promoters of that big lie about weapons of mass destruction. So they want their readers to really understand what's going on. And also, they're very forward, what would you say? They're forward positioning in the sense of putting forth ideas. You have no idea where I'm going, do you?
No, I kind of do know where you're going.
Well,
I
because
do.
I haven't let on a bit, which is probably bad radio.
No, I think I knew where you were going when you started. Yeah.
Okay, so what I've been beginning to read, rather than the news, which is on the front page, is the financial section. Because that's the underpinning of all modern societies, the economy. And that's what all the fuss is about. I mean, there's some moral issues and all that. But ultimately, it's the economic base that's at issue. And the New York Times readership, I can't even imagine what the median income. I'm sure I'd drag it down considerably.
Me too.
Whatever. So on page 2 of the business section on November 11th, the name of the column, it's a column, and it had a number of news items. And it was called BreakingViews.com. Didn't mean they were, like, breaking views. They were, this meant, you know, in the newspaper talk, something is breaking a story. Written by 3 people. I should have done some work and found out. I was just thinking that tonight. Martin Hodges,
Edward Hodges, Martin Hutchinson, Anthony Curry.
Yeah, I don't know who these guys are. But here's what they say. Here's the headline. American wages out of balance. I'm thinking, yeah, they sure are. We're getting screwed. We're not getting paid enough and what have you. And, you know, we got one of the lowest minimum wages in the industrialized world. And, so many low-waged workers are working their butts off, don't get health care and all that. So I thought, yeah, well, maybe here. This is the social conscience, the liberal social conscience of the New York Times. No. Here's what it says. American workers are overpaid.
Overpaid. Yeah. I know, don't gasp, everyone.
Yeah. American workers are overpaid relative to equally productive employees elsewhere doing the same work. If the global economy is to get into balance, that gap must close. Does that have any real, direct, dramatic meaning to you? If it doesn't, let me just say it again, and then I'll maybe you don't even need me to tell you what it means. American workers are overpaid, say our trio, writing in the business section of the New York Times, relative to equally productive employees elsewhere doing the same work. Well, where do we think, we use that phrase, where in the world do you think these equally productive employees elsewhere are? Could they be Vietnam, China, Honduras, Mexico?
Right.
So if you're an auto worker that isn't second tier and making only $14 an hour, in fact, you're getting rewarded kind of commensurate with the kind of work that you do and the value and wealth you produce, you're making $25, $28 an hour. what these people are looking at are your counterparts in Mexico, who are making like $2.50 right. an hour. So what they're talking about, if the global economy is to get into balance, that gap must close. So what they want, I mean, they don't even talk about bringing the wages of these unfortunate, our fellow workers, as the old industrial workers of the world used to correctly call them, our fellow workers, rather than saying we ought to be raising what's paid to our fellow workers in Mexico and around the world. Of course, and they continue, of course, workers in the United States should earn more than their peers in China, Moldova, or Vietnam. Well, thank you, guys.
Really?
Yeah, thank you. We really appreciate that.
Yeah.
We've only had hundreds and hundreds of people die at the hands of National Guards, cops, goons, Pinkerton detectives, and what have you, to eke out a middle-class wage for working people. Americans take advantage of the higher productivity that makes their country rich. Better education, infrastructure, abundant capital, and a strong work ethic. But how much higher should American wages be? The answer depends in part on two measures. The difference in productivity in making goods that can be traded across borders. See, it starts to get too technical. I don't even want to. And the quantity of such good. Both measures point to a narrowing wage gap. The global wage gap has been narrowing, but recent what means we're going down.
Yes.
They ain't going up, so we're going down. We're going down. It's a race to the bottom. They're saying we're all going to be, at the bottom. We're not all going to be at the bottom. They're going to remain at the top, and they're going to be even more obscenely wealthy than they are currently. I should have played our little song.
It's a doggone shame the way the big boss plays the game. It's a doggone shame.
It's a doggone shame. They work you like a mule. They treat you like a dog. It's a doggone shame. Well, the article continues where they're saying in this article that American workers are overpaid. One indicator is unemployment, which has risen unexpectedly rapidly. The 7.3 million jobs lost are more than triple the 2 million during the Reagan recession. I said Reagan. They just give the dates. Some of that huge increase reflects the sharp decline in gross domestic product. Do you think so? Like maybe the banksters caused the collapse? But there should be another factor. The recession shows that many workers are paid more than they're worth. Now, how do you figure out how much is worth? That's where class warfare, or they used to call it back in the day of the unions in the 30s and before that, class struggle. One class struggling against the other. This small, teeny class of rulers and owners. So the big, I'm not talking, if you own a little shop, I'm not even talking about you guys. I'm talking about, who's creating the policy. So when people tried to organize from, say, the 1830s through the 1950s, they were shot down, beaten up, blackballed, blacklisted, run out of town, whatever. I mean, the ruling classes used murder in intimidation because they wanted to continue to work people as long as 16 hours a day. They wanted child labor. They wanted no safety conditions, absolutely no medical care or retirement, no weekend, nothing. And they were willing to kill to maintain this because this has to do with the distribution of income. So when workers say that we want an 8-hour day rather than, I think by then they maybe got it down to the 10 and 12-hour day, that when we want an 8-hour day, but we want the same pay, that's redistribution of income. That's what that is. When workers say we don't want to work 6 or sometimes even 7 days a week, we want to work 5 days and get the same pay, that's redistribution of income. When a worker says, I don't want to work for absolutely nothing, I want another dollar a day. That was a big deal back then. And if that is one, if all of the massacres against working people, labor unions and what have you, if they weren't successful and people finally won a particular given struggle, and they got a dollar a day more, that is redistribution of income. So that goes on all the time. Let's see, the big trade deficit is another sign of excessive pay for Americans. That couldn't possibly be the rulers' misguided policies and the fact that they have screwed everything up. Do you understand what's going on here? They're trying to take this failure of American capitalism out of the backs of working people. So, because when you get to it, there's another little thing. One explanation for the attractive prices of imported goods is that American workers are paid too much relative to their foreign peers. Global wage convergence is great for the poor, but tough on the overpaid. So that means if you or your forebears or all of our forebears here in the Detroit area who did these struggles for union recognition in the 1930s, we're the overpaid. Let's see. There's the big one. It's possible to run the numbers to show, and here's where it comes now, and here's where the class divide comes. It's possible to run the numbers to show that American manufacturing workers should take average real wage cuts of as much as 20% to get into global balance. Mm. So, guys, gals, hell yeah, that's what Sarah Palin says. Guys and gals, hey, she's a multimillionaire, so don't ever believe that she or any of these people have your interest.
Even more so now.
Yeah, and don't think I have your best interests at heart. Have your own best interests at heart and act on them. And you think, man, this is terrible. This is scaring the hell out of me. They're talking, they're these guys that got the power that are the mouthpiece of the guys that make the decisions and pay the wages, and they want to cut my salary, my hourly, by 20%. What the hell can I do? I don't know. I mean, I would have a few suggestions, but this is something that you got to think real strongly about yourself. You have to protect yourself. You have to protect your family. You have to protect your future, because they have nothing in mind for you other than serfdom, to drive your wages down to what it was in the 19th century so you could reproduce yourself, and that's it. In other words, you could get fed, you could have a roof over your head. They probably, let you have a television to, keep you distracted and all that. But other than that, but hey, these guys aren't all terrible. They say the required cut of 20% may be smaller, but if American wages get stuck above global market clearing levels, as in the 1930s, the result could well be something approaching Depression-era levels of unemployment. So, in other words, if you, this says manufacturing. I don't do manufacturing, and a lot of people go, whew, all right, man, it's not me. I'm in service industry, or I'm a white-collar worker, so it's just going to screw these blue-collar guys. They don't do anything except turn a bolt on an assembly line. Look at them. They live in St. Clair Shores and Taylor, and they got boats and motorcycles, and they got a cottage up at Higgins Lake and all that, Yeah, you're right. They should take 20%.
They should have a cottage.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is blackmail. This is capitalist blackmail. This is what they're saying is, you got two choices. Either have Depression-era levels of unemployment, or you take a 20% wage cut. Which is it? This is, which of your children should we kill?
Right.
Or something like that. I mean, that's the devil's choices that these devils are presenting us with. And if this is all that we can, come up with, we're in real trouble. And if you're going, phew, God, they're only talking about American workers, American manufacturing workers are overpaid. You're thinking, man, manufacturing? We still doing any manufacturing here? Well, a few. But back to Rick's email about he's concerned that his taxes are going for someone else's housing, healthcare, utilities, cell phones, and bridge cards. Again, without either the foresight or the critical ability or the human kindness to, rather than looking at people below you, to look at the source of the problem, those above you, above us, that are making the key decisions about what happens in all of our lives. And, they make wars, they make money off it. And that's what I said to him. It's going to the military-industrial complex. Billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions, trillions, like that. That's where your money's going, Rick. You you don't want somebody to get a bridge card so they can get a damn meal?
For real.
And, there's no more able-bodied men on welfare. You're talking about kids. You're talking about disabled. You're talking about women with kids. I don't want them to have a bridge card. Throw them off. But when you talk to people like this and you say, look at the welfare that's given to corporations. Look at the billions of dollars that are given in farm aid to agribusinesses that are putting out genetically modified food. Look at the fact that we got the highest ratio of the absolute number of prisoners and the absolute highest ratio of any industrialized country. And you go on and on like that. And say, that's where all your money's going, man. Why aren't you pissed at them? And they go, well, I don't like that either.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to work in the welfare department, and my job.
You did?
I did. Actually, it was a very distasteful job. I mean, even though it probably had to be done. They don't even do it anymore. I was an investigator to make sure that people were eligible for their stipend, that they weren't scamming.
Were you really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I did not know this.
I didn't do it for very long.
So how'd that go?
We didn't get along. The big boss played the game. what I saw was 99% of the people on that were authentically poor. And if you have a society that has such a maldistribution of wealth, so you have the highest amount of people in poverty of any industrialized country in the world. In fact, let me see, where's the old website? Thank you. That's a tough one sometimes. You go to Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. There's an article, U.S. fails to measure up on human index. So these people, they're only talking about how can these guys that wrote about the American workers are overpaid and they ought to take a 20% cut. Let's open it up. Are there people among us that think, and I'll tell you what, I won't give you a real hard time. Maybe I won't give you a hard time at all. Are there people that think, yeah, our industrial workers, our people in manufacturing are overpaid? Because you know what? I'll let you talk, and then who I'll let answer you are some of the people that work in those industries. So you can call it 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Peter Werbe and Jalene Jordan with you on WRIF. In this article on my website, did I say what it was? Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. U.S. fails to measure up on a human index. Nation slumps from second to 12th on a global table. Richest fifth, in other words, the upper 20% of our country, take home $168,000. The poorest 20%, $11,000. So we're talking about a nation that's wrecked with poverty. And the other one is, let me see, I thought I took that out. Because that's in this, not letting you get a word in edgewise. Yeah,
Peter, I'm used to this.
I'm on a roll.
Go on your roll.
This is what I saw too. Financial literacy, the time is now. When it comes to financial matters, Americans are functionally illiterate. That's the growing consensus among policymakers and educators, many of whom contend that the country's lack of financial sophistication is one cause of its current economic problem. In other words, it wasn't these banksters, as my friend Tom calls them. I'm stealing that word. But rather, it's because of us, because we weren't smart enough. You know, I hate to tell you this, but when I signed my mortgage, and this was a few years ago, I figured out, I believed, and I'm maybe naively, but nothing happened, that these guys did the same kind of thing all the time. I didn't have to read everything. I didn't read the big print. I just signed my name, saw what I had to pay.
I didn't either, Peter.
Yeah, because I thought, so that would make me a functionally financial illiterate. But listen, it says, perhaps... I guess I should read the sentence before this. Advocates for financial literacy are seizing on the economic crisis as an opportunity to confront the issue directly. And it says, thanks to the recession, they're getting response from governments, nonprofits, schools, and employers. Perhaps that's because there is plenty of evidence when it comes to money. Americans really don't know what they're doing. The success... I'm having trouble reading this. I'm so...
Slow. Take a deep breath.
I know. I'm actually kind of angry about all this because, talking about cutting people's wages...
Yeah.
Give me a break.
That's the last thing we need to hear right now.
Yeah. The recession has produced thousands of anecdotes of Americans buried in debt, stuck in foolish mortgages, or stung by huge investment losses. And that's because the financial system is run by hucksters and thieves. That's not because we're illiterate. Who can understand these, what they call, exotic instruments? Why should we have an economy that has exotic instruments? All the exotic instruments should be banned. I think, look, I mean, I get my foolish self out here in public, so I better know what I'm talking about. But I cannot get my mind around any of those exotic instruments.
Right.
I mean, I read them, and then they go, like, if you called and said, what's a derivative? I go, I can't even remember what that
is. Yeah, retaining it is the problem.
And you know what? I shouldn't have to, and you shouldn't have to. We should live in a society where we're all part of a community, well, where we should take it for granted that the smiling bankster in his $1,500 suit wearing his $8,000 Rolex isn't out there to rob you. We expect that of a thug with a gun, right? We go, oh, man, here's a guy. What's he? Oh, he pulled a gun out of his pocket. There's something bad's going to happen to me. But then you go, hi, I'm Charles Smith. I represent the, you know, like that. You go, oh, man, this guy's got my interest at heart. Why doesn't he have your interest at heart? I mean, under the best model of capitalism, which it rarely ever meets, everybody should be able to function in a straightforward manner and still do all right. And an economy ought to be most of us working for wages, get paid decently and with all the benefits that one would expect out of a modern society. And if you own a business, pay people decent wages, provide for them. If you, we're not going to have national health care, provide a health care plan and retirement and what have you, and sell stuff and end of financial system. But this thing, this giant Ponzi scheme called the stock market, money makes money. It's all speculative capital. No, you know, hey, fast story. It's all going to collapse unless we intervene. We, the people, do what we've done in the past. Make history. If we don't, well, we're just little objects to be acted upon. Global poll, widespread dissatisfaction with free market capitalism. 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, a new BBC poll has found widespread dissatisfaction with free market capitalism. Whoa. And in the global poll for the BBC World Service, only 11% of those questioned across 27 countries said that it was working well. Most thought regulation and reform of the capitalist system were necessary. I always wonder, who are these 11? You know who the 11% are?
Who?
Well, probably about 5 or 6% of them are the people in the upper classes. And then the rest of them, just these stooges of the wealthy who echo their...
They have to say it, right.
Yeah. More than 29,000 people in 27 countries were questioned. In only two countries, the United States and Pakistan, did more than one in five people feel that capitalism works as well as it stands. Almost a quarter, 23% of those responded, feel it is fatally flawed. Now, most people thought that it's flawed, but 23% think it's fatally flawed. I would agree. I'm in the 23%. And there is strong support around the world for governments to distribute wealth more evenly. That is backed by majorities in 22 of the 27 countries. Now, we're not talking about distributing it more equally from people that aren't making squat to begin with or are in the middle class. That's not who the money is taken from. I mean, people that you get these people say, I'm working three jobs, you know. You're not talking about taking money from you. We're talking about creating a society where you only have to work one job. Where you work one job and you get well paid. Where you work one job and you get to see your family.
Yeah,
where you,
quality of life.
Yeah, where you work one day and 1 week. And that provides you with what you need.
Yeah.
Not another couple of jobs. All right.
Well, do you feel better?
No.
Not at all.
No.
You're even more angry.
Yeah. Well, let me see. We got some open lines. We can always talk about Carrie Prejean's sex tapes. Now it's tapes, no longer tape. But this is important. So these folks from the New York Times, they're suggesting that industrial workers
make too much
and take a 20% cut in their pay to equalize with or not equalize with the, but that's coming.
Yeah. Boo on those three guys who wrote this article.
Yeah, yeah. But you believe it, that there's policymakers at the top that are thinking, and you go, well, yeah, you know, I go to work every day, and I got a nice white shirt, nice cool tie, a good suit, nice watch, big goal, what do you call those phones?
iPhones.
And stuff like that. So, yeah, screw those guys. They make too much anyway. Why should somebody that just works in a plant, someone that gets dirty working, why should they make a lot of money? They maybe only should make 80% of what they're making now. Hey, they come for you next. You know that whole thing that minister said in Germany, first they came for the Jews, and I didn't say anything, and then they came for the communists, and I didn't say anything, then they came, and then it goes through a whole long list, and then they came for me, and there was no one to defend me.
There you go.
So, yeah, they want to restructure this world so the pyramid of wealth looks exactly like it did in the 19th century, maybe more, maybe going back, maybe, who knows, maybe they want to go back to feudalism. We're on our way, folks, unless we fight back. I mean, they're involved. They got their generals. They've got their armies already. And what do we got? Well, all right, let's talk about that. Lots else as well. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
775-608-8877. Not available in all states. That's Debt Settlement USA. 1-877-560-8877. 1-877-560-8877.
There's something happening across America. People aren't just calling themselves DirecTV customers. They're calling themselves fans. That's because DirecTV has exclusive sports packages like NFL Sunday Ticket and free NASCAR Hot Pass. DirecTV has the most HD channels with over 130, soon to be over 200, and 50 times more movies available in 1080p. Perhaps that's why DirecTV is ranked number one in customer satisfaction among all TV service providers. So don't just watch TV. Become a huge fan. Switch to DirecTV today. Call 1-888-359-5566. There's no equipment to buy and no startup costs. Packages start at just $29.99 a month. Call 1-888-359-5566. That's 1-888-359-5566. Sports subscriptions sold separately. New customers only on approved credit. Credit card required except Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. Hardware lease and programming commitment required and available separately. Other conditions apply. Call for details. Did you know that tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Line scale deposits block the heating element, which cost you up to 25% more. That's an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove line scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy. With HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents line scale buildup in your entire plumbing system, guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com.
This is your Car Care Minute. With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely. First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure, and be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now's the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
It's a doggone shame the way the big boss plays the game. It's a doggone shame the way the big boss plays the game.
All right, that's a little reprise there. Or is it reprise?
I think it's either.
Yeah.
Or either.
That's funny. I like that. Anyway, we're talking about this New York Times article that says American workers are overpaid. That's a quote. And they say American manufacturing workers should take average real wage cuts of as much as 20% to get into global balance.
I gotta think not.
Yeah. By the way, yeah, I mean, before that happens, look, can we talk general strike? But let's go to our phones. Here is Derek. Derek is in Southgate. Hey, Derek, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Pete. I've listened to you for a few years now and never called up, and I just wanted to get your opinion on something.
What's that?
Well, doing a little research into the New World Order, and I know a lot of people think it's a big conspiracy, you know, for conspiracy nuts and whatnot, but the more I get into it, the more it seems to make sense, especially with, anyway, I just want to get your spin on it. And
Well, not always. I mean, that's used in a lot of different ways. Doesn't it say New World Order on our dollar bills? Isn't that
something? The Nuevos Orco, yeah, whatever, that whole Masonic. Yeah.
Well, there always has been these desires on a part of the elites to reorder the world in a manner that they control it all. And I know some people on the right think there is this attempt to create this one-world government where American sovereignty would disappear. And is there that? I mean, it could be. I mean, as it is, a lot of these supranational corporations, they're not bound by any particular national laws, and things like World Trade Organization rules and what have you will even overcome some, U.S. I mean, in other words, we can't put in protectionist laws. I mean, we get screwed on trade in a lot of ways, which is a little complex to go into. Is there anything like that on the agenda, or what's that thing called, the North American Union or something?
Oh, right.
I don't think so. I mean, but one of the things that we got to do, whether it is or it isn't, we still have to function the same. In other words, we need to combine in a manner politically and perhaps even like they used to do a long time ago, industrial or at the workplace, in order to stop these assaults on our communities, that depriving it of wages, that refuses to take out of these enormous profits that are being made, the wherewithal of the kind of life that we and everyone else in the world should have. That would be a new world order, but not based on a bunch of elites manipulating everything for their benefit. I mean, there's about 95% of us and 5% of them. I mean, I think it's time we've had our way with them.
Yeah, well, yes. Right. We will.
Well, thank you, Derek. Appreciate that. Let's see. Here is Josh in Detroit. Hi, Josh. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hey, Peter. Hi, Julie. How you doing?
We're doing
great.
Good.
Thanks.
You know, I really have to say something about the whole make the workers 20% pay cut.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's complete bull. Because why don't the CEOs, the VPs, the PRs, why don't they all take a pay cut and let the little people, the ones who actually buy the stuff, who put them in business, why don't they make them have a pay cut? Why put the little people in a pay cut?
Well, because what's the obvious answer, Josh? They have the power to make either them or us, depending on how we're cutting it, accept those cuts. That's what always happens.
Oh, of course. But I guess my issue is why would you promote that in the newspaper? You know, we're already going through enough hard times as is.
Agreed.
You know, with all the foreclosures and everything going on, why would you put it in a newspaper stating that that the workers, the ones who make the companies run, the ones who make the world go round, they're the ones who buy all this stuff. They're the ones going out. They're the ones doing everything. And you want to make them make less money so they can't provide for their families. They can't provide for themselves. Like you were saying, they have to work 2-3 jobs in order to do anything. Where's the social life? You have no sense of community with a whole nation. It's all individuals.
Yeah,
and it needs to.
That is the key to it, right? I mean, we have no power as individuals. I mean, these so-called libertarians, they say, well, if you don't like it, you can go work at another place. That's the kind of freedom you have. Well, that's not much of a freedom. And the only way, see, what they're talking about, our labor sells as a commodity. In other words, if you're pricing something, you've got to figure out what you're going to charge for it. Well, we try to figure out what we want to charge for our labor, except we have no capacity to put a price on it at all. It's put on by the market. The market, because there's so many of us, that wage will really get driven down. So along, a couple generations ago, they figured they needed a statutory selling price of labor, so they established the minimum wage. Because it was up to the kind mercies of the people that run things and hire people, if they could hire people here for $3 an hour, they would do it. If they could go back to hiring 8- and 9-year-olds at half a wage, the way they did in the 19th, into the 20th century even, they would do that. So they have to be controlled greatly. That selling price of labor has to be controlled. So the other thing that happened was that people combined into unions in order to force up the selling price of labor. And, of course, the people that did that are grandfathers and what have you were met by guns and clubs and laws and court orders and what have you, because the owners did not want to redistribute the wealth. And that's what essentially it was about. If we ask for more money, that's wealth redistribution. But I agree with you. Thank you, Josh. I appreciate your call. Absolutely. Let's see. Here is Dan. Dan's in Oakland County, which is a big county, but welcome to the broadcast, Dan. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, listen, I actually work for one of the auto companies. I spent quite a bit of time in China working out there.
Uh-huh.
I am not an executive. And I got to tell you guys, like a lot of these ideas that people are talking, I mean, they're good ideas. But you need to spend more time thinking on them because, you know, if you look at the scientific and the dollars and cents and actually do the math, they don't make sense. For instance, if some of these top executives, and I'm not going to name names here, but some of them are gone out of the industry now. If you were to have taken their wage and redistributed it to every worker,
it wouldn't make
I did
much.
The math. It was $14 a year.
No. Listen, I think a lot of that is just representative, or that it's sort of emblematic of what's happening. People are getting screwed, and then you see people in the bankster industry getting these literally, in some totals of billions of dollars, or somebody like Mulally with Ford Motor. He's asking people to take wage cuts, and he's getting millions of dollars a year. Well, obviously, if he took his $14-15 million a year, whatever he made last year, and distributed to all Ford workers, it wouldn't amount to much. But what we got, in my estimation, and I've just been yakking, so let me just finish this sentence, Dan, and I'll turn it back to you. What we got to do is create a system in which the stockholders or the companies themselves don't realize as large a profit. So in other words, instead of taking 20% wage cuts, let's have a 20% profit cut for what what people earn through stock investment. Now, one of the things you could say, well, wait a minute, man, I got a 401k.
Yeah.
So what they've done is they've kind of, it's called, I can't say the word on the air, a cluster,
uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
And so they've got us all mixed up in together. So, and we wind up on our end of it kind of dog eat dog. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, the point being here is, number one, the consumers have to make the choice, okay? You have to stop buying foreign goods. The consumers have to do that. So this is what you need to be preaching to your people, not these other ideas of wealth redistribution. And if you're going to preach that, I really encourage you to take half your wage and go give it to somebody who works at McDonald's. Unless you're not willing to do that, you really shouldn't be preaching it. You should preach things that actually make sense.
Well, yeah, Peter's not the head guy around here.
I'm kind of talking about myself too, but I don't think the head guy around here should do it. That's not even the question. We're talking about a whole system, but
a lot more money, so you need to give them yours according to your theory.
Okay, I'll consider it. I actually do tithe, if you will. Give money a certain percentage of my income.
Yes, you do.
To people. In fact, I guess they know I'm coming. I'm this inner city project that does people. I don't know. I don't want to get off it. I talked about it, but that's where Danny Glover, the actor, was.
Oh yes,
So we're gonna drop a few bucks off and a computer tomorrow.
Okay, so there you go.
Yeah, but I mean, that's not half my salary, anything like that.
You kind of need to live. And,
yeah,
you know.
I mean, but that's not the point. We're talking about how a whole society is structured. And if you, like they asked Mullally from the CEO of Ford when he was before Congress, they said, would you work for a dollar a year? And he's an extremely wealthy man.
Yeah.
He could. It wouldn't be hurt a bit. And he said, I'm comfortable where I am.
Yeah, sure.
And that was like $14 million a year. So if he would have said, what if he would have said, yeah, I'll work for a dollar a year and $14 million can be sent into retraining or certainly divvying up among the Ford workers. I'm trying to think $14 million. Well, yeah, might, even if it was $100, I'd probably go for it. But whatever. That's not the problem. Here's Kevin in Canton. Kevin, hi. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Julian. How are you today?
We're good.
Great.
Yeah, this economy is just for the birds. I remember back in the mid-90s when things, I don't know why, seemed better. Obviously, times have changed. But I got back on track in April as a painting contractor. And 2 weeks ago, I worked for several contractors. I subcontract. And 2 weeks ago, I first week without a paycheck. And now it's like, a small guy like me to fend for myself with no insurance and benefits and, dental issues and what have you. It's just like, I wish I was like the police and I could just pull you over because your house needs to be painted and that's it.
There's good one.
And the good thing is, my band Poker Face, we played the shelter last night and the guy come out, he wanted to be our roadie. I gave him $2. He didn't have a job. The guy on the street, Darnell, he's like, who's this guy? Yep, he's our roadie.
Hey, I think that band is played on Motor City Riffs, right?
Poker Face?
Yeah.
We're hoping to get it, but last night we played the shelter. It was supposed to be with Pop Evil and Steven Abel, but Steven Abel's singer was swine flu.
Oh, well,
oh no.
Yeah, well, one of the way you and other bands can get on the air is send it into Motor City Riffs.
Yeah, get it.
Lick the, what do they say, the frigging stamp, or what do they all say?
I don't
frigging,
know what they
something
say.
Something like that.
I
yeah.
don't know.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin, for joining us. Let's see. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And let me do this before we get on it. People are, there's a couple open lines so people could talk more about this. But now we can talk about Carrie Prejean.
It's that time.
Yeah. She got a brand new book out called Still Standing. Although
is anyone going to buy this thing?
Well, they said it's already, it was came out at $30 and it's already on Amazon for $10.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And the introduction was written by Sean Hannity. And I mean, she had.
Oh, yeah, Sean Hannity wrote the intro. I mean, yeah. These writings are coming to her defense. I mean, continually.
Yeah, it said the tape in question, this is an old newscast, or no, an old news story. The tape in question was shopped around for several months with a $10,000 price tag, but site after site turned it down.
It was just her by
just
herself.
Her. Yeah, sort of doing some handiwork.
Yeah.
Right, if you will. And then it turns out, where do you have that story, don't you? That it's actually on my website. Someone said, how could you put this? Of all the stuff that's going on, the lead story on my website, which is Peter Werby.
And if anyone doesn't know who she is, because some people probably don't.
Go ahead.
She was...
Miss California.
She was, wasn't she up for it, but she didn't win, right?
Or was she won that. She was up for Miss USA.
Oh, okay, that's what it was, and she didn't win that.
And she gave...
Miss California said that she doesn't believe that gay marriage is...
And she says that is why she did not get selected as Miss USA, instead Miss North Carolina won. But, yeah, there's no way to tell. I mean, maybe she would have... I mean, it seemed like an odd question to ask in a silly-ass pageant. Anyways, yeah. I can't believe these things still exist.
Well, and I can't either. Everything's been tumbling downward, spiraling downward for this woman after that. And she tried to sue the pageant. And then they said, oh, then the sex tape thing came up, and she goes, oh, okay, and she settled. She sued for big money.
She settled for nothing. She got nothing.
Oh, nothing?
Nothing. Right. No, she didn't get anything. So anyway, as it says on my website, now it's not sex tape, it's tapes. 30 nude photos, 8 sex tapes of Carrie Prejean surface. And the deal is, and why are we even bothering, why in the world, because the next story is about Afghanistan and then healthcare, you'd think.
She talks about morals and values, that's why.
Yeah, because she is such a hypocrite, and they all are. So she's just now going on every one of these right-wing talk shows.
Well, she went on Larry King, and she left the show, which was, if anyone saw this, or if you didn't, it's worth a YouTube on this thing. It is so funny. She got so upset with him. She took her mic off and then still sat there in the chair in her own little room, and she kept talking to him with their mic off.
So Larry, I don't know if you saw this, but Larry King says to her, so why did you settle the suit? And she says, Larry, that's completely inappropriate. And he looked, I mean, because he does no show prep. I mean, he doesn't read books before he interviews people. He doesn't find, I mean, he just wants to go in there cold. And it's sort of like, he wants to be like the viewer. So
yeah, sure.
Ask those same kind of question. And he said, why is that inappropriate? I mean, he looked like he couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And one, remember now, she went on Hannity's show and TV show, and she said, this is so humiliating to have to go on television and talk about it.
So don't. Then why are you here? And Ann Coulter, that evil right-wing bitch from hell, she has come to... No one wants Ann Coulter to come to your defense. I mean, really.
I don't even know what the defense is. What we're just having is a ball.
That she's trying to teach Carrie, you know, how to conduct her life in a better, you know, way, in a more conservative way. Respectable way.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that when you're so self-righteous and she's talking about Christian values, then you just look like a total fraud and a hypocrite. If it came out that Jolene had... Do you have any sex tapes?
I don't.
You don't.
That I know of.
I put in Jolene Jordan sex tapes into Google. I did.
Peter Werby. And you found nothing.
But then I put in Peter Werby sex tapes.
Yeah. And you have a bunch of them, I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, but that's the thing. If they found out that you and I had them,
So what?
Yeah, I would say, yeah, so what?
Peace-loving hippies?
That's what I wanted to do. None of your business. You want to put them on the Internet? Good. If I had them, they'd be on my website.
No, they wouldn't. Well, mine would.
Yeah, there you go. So they're just... And that's what I'm saying. You know, people have understandably got turned off of Barack Obama because the real change hasn't been here. The new health care bill sucks. The guy's he's getting making plans to expand the war in Afghanistan. I mean, he's done tons of stuff to unravel the monstrous presidency of Bush and Darth Vader, but still the kind of change that people expected. So liberals, progressives, leftists begin to peel off, and they say, you know, if someone says to me that there's something and then they're not, my confidence in them immediately begins to erode. These right wingers, zero. I mean, you, no matter, I think they'd have to be a serial killer before they would actually divorce themselves from the, you know, like Ted Haggard.
Oh, right.
Reverend Ted Haggard is back.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Holding a prayer meeting at his house. And Yep.
That's what they.
Good stuff, though.
But anyway, so maybe we should do this. Maybe we should just take a break. If you're on the line, please hold on. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
I don't even think we have to do this anymore. I think we have Mr. Announcer doing it. So are we being too hard on Carrie Prejean?
Poor little Carrie.
And her handiwork. Right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
I guess we got caught up in the crazy housing boom.
We had been in the house so long, we didn't want to lose it.
What these people share is that they all got in trouble with their mortgages, and they all called a certified housing counselor for help.
Our housing counselor looked at our paperwork, and she knew something was wrong.
She understood what needed to be done, and she helped me work it out with the bank. This is a free service. Call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling now. Call 1-866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riffed rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
WRIF HD1 Detroit.
I want to hear some revolution out there, brother! I want to hear revolution! Brothers and sisters, it's time to testify. I want to know, are you ready to testify? Are you ready? I think you!
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, welcome back to our second hour of WRIF's Night Call. And our numbers are 313-298-WRIF. And, oh, yeah, I wanted to read this. We're talking about wages and what have you. Let's see. This is, I don't want to say is... Just got a first initial. Jay. Jay writes, never mind the wages, we are working harder than ever, won't make it to retirement. Whoa, that's scary.
Oh, that is very scary.
Yeah. You got anything?
And I do. In the age, this is from Yule. Oop, wait, it just went away. This computer is playing tricks with me. In the age of the military-industrial congressional complex, war is often waged for the purpose of making profit. But if it were possible to make war unprofitable, war profiteers would hopefully go into a more peace-oriented line of business.
Well, that's a dream.
Yes, sure.
I mean, because
is.
War is big business. And they say during the Vietnam War, war is good business, invest your son. And that kind of cynical and almost cruel little slogan or whatever really reflected what's going on. I mean, the working class and poor guys in the Vietnam era to tens of thousands. And actually, in this interview that you'll hear at 1 a.m., that 150,000 Vietnam-era GIs have committed suicide since that conflict. I mean, way over what you would expect. In the meantime, the contractors, everybody from the weapons manufacturers to in these wars, the contractors, they're making a fortune. I mean, that's why President Eisenhower called it the military-industrial complex. And he warned about it. And everybody said, okay, Ike, go play some golf, buddy. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Here is Marion in Dearborn. Marion, hi. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You are on the air.
Hello, Peter, Jolene.
Hi.
Well, at least Carrie got free boobs out of the deal.
She got the boobs.
Carrie Prejean.
They wanted her to pay him back for the boobs. They wanted her to pay the pageant back. Remember that?
Yeah, $5,000.
$10,000.
$10,000.
She had.
Oh, it was $5,000 a piece.
Yeah, she had very expensive boobs.
Isn't that? They don't usually cost that much, do they?
I don't. I have no idea. I was. Oh,
never mind.
I won't say.
Never you can go watch the sex tape. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mary. What?
Speaking about actual real wages and things, I'd like to know. I mean. I got my knickers in a bunch about it, just listening to you. I feel, really angry, and I have for a long time. It's just now I'm able to put more of a name to it, and become more consciously aware of it. And what can we do as people? I mean, are there any organizations or groups we could join?
Well, there's jillions of them, actually. One of the things, if you go, either go to michaelmoore.com, or go to my website, peterwerby.com. And Michael Moore, a good Michigander, somebody used to hang around Flint and what have you before he came big time, and knows all that stuff firsthand. He's got a number of suggestions. But one of the things that's got to happen, Miriam, in what happens initially is just a small group of people start being involved in activism. And sometimes it goes on for years, and they feel it's hopeless, and a lot of even some of those committed activists peel off because it's just so unrewarding and discouraging. And then suddenly something happens, but things are beginning to percolate all around the country. I mean, you can do some things. Like, for instance, there's a movie producer, Robert Greenwald, Greenwald. Again, you might be able to go to it through my site. Actually, there is. There's a little short about Afghanistan right at the top. Top of mind. And one of the things that he encourages people to do is to take his films and get people together. Could be your neighbors, could be your friends, union, church, something like that. And even if you're kind of isolated, everybody, I hope, knows two or three people.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, wow, all right, that worked well. Maybe we ought to show another one next month. I'm not saying that's the only thing you can do. A lot of people feel uncomfortable about going out to public demonstrations where you actually have to hold a sign. There's a lot
of that.
You
can go and not hold a sign.
Yeah, or there's yesterday, Juan Cole, who's a professor at University of Michigan, gave a public talk on Afghanistan. It was out in Huntington Woods, which is not exactly near you. But things go on all the time. It's a matter of how do we find out? And I've actually my my website calendar looked pretty bare. I've got something for June 2010.
Really?
Other than that, so folks, if you got events,
send them on.
Send them on. Yeah, but it's a matter of getting hooked in. Once you're hooked into this, then all of this is you know pretty evident. All right, thank you very much. And it also is something that we don't have to, like now, it's a real effort to find out what to do. And it's real, if you've never done anything, it's like odd behavior. Like Jalene to me, someone says, hey, we're having a demonstration next Saturday. Okay, you know, we'll be there. Here's a demonstration. This takes quite a bit of doing to go to it. This is an email from Tim, who was listening in Georgia. He wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Could you mention the annual protest at Fort Benning, Georgia? It's happening next week, November 20 through the 22nd. It's at the School of the Americas. Now, one of the things, where is our money going? And began the show talking about Rick, who was concerned about how his money was being taken from him and given to the poor. Well, what happens here? The government takes it. It gives it to the School of the Americas. They changed the name, but still called that, and they train all these Latin American troops. There's not as many going because now that so many governments in Latin America are run by presidents who actually have some concern for the people, they just kind of stuck with, I don't know what, Colombia or something like that, where billions of our dollars are going. Anyways, Rick, that's where your money's going, is down to this death squad government of Colombia. So you can go to soawatch.org. You go, wow.
I want to go.
Wait a minute. You're going to go to the first one? You're going to go to Georgia? Actually, Bob King, who's head of the Ford Department of the United Auto Workers, I don't know if he's still doing it, but every year he usually takes down a contingent.
Huh.
It's run by a Catholic priest,
yeah.
Father Roy Bourgeois.
Yeah.
What a name.
Great guy.
Who's a great guy who doesn't give you any God pitch at all. He speaks there, doesn't mention the Lord or anything like that. So it's kind of faith-based, which really usually isn't my thing, but I have so much respect for these people and they don't try to push it on you. They're not like these right-wing evangelicals, you know.
Oh, jeez.
They're carrying out their own, you know, personal witness for what they see as doing God's work on earth. So it's soawatch.org. Or you can just look at that to get an idea kind of what's going on.
Yeah.
Here's Kevin in Sterling Heights. Kevin, it's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have a couple questions. First of all, how much money is enough?
Well, that's always that's partly an ethical question. I agree.
My biggest thing is I work for the auto industry, and I know a lot of managers and engineering groups and educated, you know, spend a lot of money on education to go to work. And everybody at the auto industry is making more than their managers and their upper management.
Is that
what the Wall Street was talking about?
You know, I don't know. I just think they ultimately probably want to have all labor at a price below what it currently is, because that would mean more profits. So whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, what the thing is like a lot of manufacturing right now
isn't
profitable. That's the problem.
Well,
it's not profitable.
Well, it's not the wages that got us in the hole in the first place, and cutting wages I don't think is what's, I don't know. I mean, it might help. The wages aren't that big a factor. I mean, they want, I mean, for every dime they pay less, for whatever stupid agreement the UAW enters into to have workers come in at half the wage, it just means that's more money that's going to the stockholders. So that's class warfare. That's redistribution of wealth. So it's redistribution of wealth upwards. I mean, people always say you're a commie if you want, if you want redistribution of wealth downward from the ultra wealthy to the average person who's, you know, in the trenches, whether they got white collar or blue collar. But what does it mean if it's the redistribution is going upwards?
Yeah.
I think he had one more thing.
What? Yeah.
My other thing was I heard you make a comment about Alan Mulally, about when he made the comment of I'm pretty good where I'm at.
Yeah.
I think that all leads back to the Lee Iacocca. I mean, that whole government deal was the big three went in there and said, well, you take a dollar for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the two that were in deep, dire straits that had nothing to do, which is Chrysler and GM, they said, yeah, I'll do it. And the one guy that actually had a plan said, well, I mean, we aren't here to take your money. We're going to try to, you know, I'm just saying, when do you say that you make too much money? I mean, somebody works for their whole life and proves themselves out and makes large amounts of money for a company and knows how to run a company. When do you say you make too much money?
Well, there was a book out a few years ago that said everything I know I learned in kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was if you don't, can't bring candy unless you have enough to share with everybody. And we have a country that has so many poor people, so many people struggling that are working every day, so many middle-class people that are struggling. It's kind of obscene to see people making millions because it's not even wealth that they can expend. I mean, you or I may, you know, if we got a $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 more a year or something, or $100,000 more a year, we'd probably find some stuff to, to put it into.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're getting up in those millions, it's just sort of the psychosis of greed, as far as I'm concerned. All right, Kevin, thank you. Appreciate your comments.
Peter, an email from Don, who says, buying, this ought to inflame a few folks out there. Buying American is bull, he said. If you make a good product, it will sell. If you don't care, you will go under, like GM and Chrysler.
Well, you can make a real effort. I mean, I hate to say it, folks, because I didn't make any real effort at this, but I suspect there is very little that I have on my body that was made in the USA,
yeah.
Right? And you have to go to extraordinary lengths to find products that are made here. Like, go find a pair of shoes that are made here in the
I don't know. US. I'm wearing Crocs. Aren't they made in the United States?
Beats me. Could be.
Yeah.
But I think I've used the example before of Rockport shoes that were always made in Rockport, Maine. I used to, on my trips to Maine, I always used to grab a pair almost every summer.
Really?
And now, guess where? China.
Are they really?
Yeah. What should have happened? The United States, if it really represented the interest of the American people rather than the interest of the international corporations or even the national corporations that became international when they started manufacturing abroad, they should have put in some major disincentive to have any work go out of this country. In other words, when you brought it back in, if you didn't make your shoes in Rockport, Maine, and you were calling them Rockport and they were being shipped in for China, and there's a lot of other factors that go into it that they're getting a free ride on, they should have said, well, there's going to be like a $20 tax on every pair of shoes. And they would have thought, wow. Don't like it that these Rockport workers are unionized. Don't like it that we have to give them a health care plan. Don't like it that we got to pay for their retirement. We like it that we can have our shoes made in sweatshops where there's no safety or other health considerations and no retirement or anything like that. So a government that protected its people would not have allowed these jobs to escape because these corporations are, objectively, they are, let's only say it, they're motivated by profit. And if they can reduce cost, that's you and me, friends, if they can reduce cost, see, they can't outsource. This could be famous last words. They can't outsource our jobs here, Jalene and mine. But they can, doing manufacturing. And, for instance, if the government wasn't going to do it, when Ford, for instance, said they were going to move plants to Mexico, the UAW should have called a general strike. They should have brought out, and they could have done it back then. When they tried to move the plants in the 1950s, when the deindustrialization began, and the company started moving to these non-union shops in the South, the United Auto Workers should have said, we're calling out a strike of all auto companies, and we want to bring every other labor union with us. We're stopping this country until you agree not to destroy the wage standards of U.S. workers not union workers, but U.S. workers, of which we're the most organized sector, that we won't allow Detroit to be destroyed by deindustrialization because you don't want to pay living wages instead are going to be part of this slaveocracy in Mexico and China and Vietnam and wherever else. But, you know, no, everybody just said, well, okay, or just there, I got a little peace of mind right now, so it's going to be okay. And they still got a little piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they still got the big headquarters down on East Jefferson and all that, but it's shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And who knows? They may not even have the power to do anything now. We might have to reinvent some forms. Have you ever heard anybody in your life talk like this, folks? You know, if you travel in what some of you would think would be the wrong circles or what I think are the right circles, this is common parlance. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Matt in Plymouth. Hi, Matt. You're on the air. Hey, Matt. Matt.
Where
Matt.
Are you?
Matt, you're on hold, Matt. We're putting you back on hold. Let's see. Here is Dave in Westland. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
Dave.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
20% would put me under.
Let's remind people. Right. Let's remind people what we're talking about. Guys in the New York Times said American workers need a 20% wage cut. Yeah.
Like, are they out of their minds?
Yeah, I'm looking at my paycheck here. I'm a single white guy with no dependents. I gross over $2,000 every 2 weeks, and I bring home just over $1,300. That's ridiculous. So I'm paying for bridge cards and everybody else's diapers, and yet I'm having problems with my bill.
Let's go back. Dave, we started
off on a good note, but this went south real fast.
Don't worry.
Don't worry about the bridge cards.
Don't worry about the bridge card. That's a teeny little percentage of the taxes you're paying. The big money is going to the big guys. The multi-billion-dollar subsidies to agriculture, the hundreds of billions of dollars that are going to military contractors and what have you. Don't pick on the poor.
No, I'm not. I actually support a little girl in the Philippines.
Well, that's good. But the fact that your taxes go, I mean, go to the website of the Michigan Department of Human Resources and see who's eligible. You're talking about, if you're getting, you know, if a mother with four kids is getting a bridge card, it's to feed these kids, whatever you may think of her even. You got kids there. You don't want to kick, you sound like a generous man, even, you know, with, not a high income. You're helping somebody in another country. I mean,
no, absolutely. Yeah, I'm a Detroit police officer. I do whatever I can for whoever I can.
Okay,
well, that's good.
Yeah,
you can live outside of the city.
Oh yeah, yeah. They took away residency some years ago.
Okay, all right. Well, all right, good. I don't even know if they're. Well, yeah, I did say they're going to start with the industrial workers who have been real subject to a lot of hits, and then. Hey, they're going to go after the next strata. Could be us. Could be you. Thank you, Dave. Here's Tom in Livonia. Tom, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a Vietnam veteran, retired Chrysler worker. I've been listening to you since the 70s.
Wow.
Wow.
So I've been heard you on and off the radio and since you got – I always got you on at the wrong time at night. Should have you around prime time. But,
well, it's a rock station, so,
I know.
This is where it
anyways,
is.
You know. I look at the economics and things, and people don't follow the buck because they don't know what their dollar does or where it goes. You have to take in consideration the way we're printing money. You're losing 20% within the next couple of years in buying power, for one. Everybody's doing that. Now, the bottom line is, when Reagan was in office, he passed the ability for people to save money through our 401s. And with that 401 money, it goes to where? Most of the time, it goes to a mutual fund.
Right.
The mutual fund people invested in corporations in America, international corporations. And so when it comes to voting, where your money's being invested, it's basically going to go into a company that's going to give you a return and maybe put you out of a job. But nobody figures which way the dollar goes. So if you turn around and wage war on the investment people, which they sucked in all of the working class, you might just get a hold of this and do what you will call an industrial economic revolution.
Mm-hmm.
you know, if you can pull that one off. Otherwise, when you've got people contributing money out of their paycheck, every paycheck, to somebody where you don't have a vote on how it's being invested, forget it, man. You're hanging yourself.
No, you're right. And that's what that's interesting you say that, because there's an old phrase you may have heard. You say, either we got to hang together or we're going to hang separately, right?
But most people don't have any economic savvy. Most people, and when they get out of high school, don't even know what an amortization sheet is on a mortgage.
Yeah, well, neither did Jolene and I.
No, that's
I know what that is.
Yeah.
But it's common sense that you got to know where your dollar's going. And if you understand where your dollar's going, you could become rich, too.
Well, I don't know if you could become rich. Some people can. Most people, you know, there's always a few people that can. But mostly the class structure as we currently find it is going to pretty much remain the same. There might always have maybe a few people that can do a little better. All right. Appreciate your call. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for the info. Appreciate that. Here's Rick and Warren. Rick, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
Next Wednesday, there's a protest rally at the Federal Reserve and the Fed. And I'm the same Rick that wrote you that letter that said, what gives the government the right to, redistribute our money?
Right.
And I know it goes to stuff like the School of Americas and the CIA and all this stuff. But, you know, the Fed is part of that problem, too. They print this money that the government can just, you know, take and put us on the hook for the taxes.
Ron Paul actually has gotten quite a few sponsors to this bill, I think even bipartisan, to audit the Fed. But as I've said before, I mean, I don't have any particular like or dislike. I mean, obviously, this is this mysterious organization that says if they're transparent, that will wreck some of their ability to set monetary policy and all that. Well, that's, again, just part of the whole bankster Ponzi scheme, what have you. But I'll tell you, Rick, I can't believe for a second that if you abolish the Fed or audited the Fed or made the Fed fully a federal bank that anything significant would change.
Well, it'd be a start. they couldn't, you know, they wouldn't, if they had real sound money, okay, they wouldn't spend it like this stuff that they just create out of thin air that they'd make out of nothing.
Well, they do, but that's all, that's all policy that's made by these elitists that when they think, oh, the economy's doing bad, what do we do? Oh, we got to save all these huge financial concerns. The ones that got us into the problem in the first place, and they say, well, what about jobs? And they go, oh, yeah, well, it's going to catch up in a couple of years. In the meantime, lives are being ruined, people's homes are being lost, people are going into bankruptcy and all of that, because the elite think of the elite first, right?
Well, I mean, you know, if the people who have to throw us out of our houses don't do that, you know, refuse to do that, and then, you know, where does charity come in?
Well, you know what happened? In fact, people talk about what can we do. There's a small movement in Michigan, and unfortunately it's very small, to call a moratorium on foreclosures. There's a Michigan statute that goes back to the 30s that allows the governor of the state to declare a bankruptcy emergency or foreclosure emergency, something like that, that would stop this. It would there's people that, for instance, want to renegotiate, that have the capacity to pay, that want to renegotiate their mortgages, and the banks won't even let them. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at, if there's a problem with the Fed, or let's say the problem with the Fed is a small part of the entire piece. For instance, that right now Barack Obama is talking about sending up to 40,000 more soldiers to Afghanistan. That's at like $1 million a piece a year. So that's another $40 billion a year on top of what's already there, and probably $2 trillion that was going to be, that's going to wind up being spent on the war in Iraq. How many of those people that are the Fed are actually going to take part, like, in the anti-war movement as well? I'll bet you close to zero.
Yeah, that's right. None of them.
Yeah, and you know what? If they are kind of right-wing libertarians, the type that Ron Paul is, The antiwar.org is essentially, which is a great anti-war site, and it's essentially run by Ron Paul folks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, Rick, one more thing. Don't pick on the poor.
All right, guys.
All right.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to love this. Here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter, Jolene. How you doing?
We're doing
Maurice.
Well.
Are you up on the end game?
The what?
The end game.
Oh, the end game.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard a lot of things. The end game. It's in chess.
It's a
play by Samuel Beckett.
It's a documentary by Alex Jones.
Oh, man.
It tells about things that kind of go on in the world.
That guy's...
Give you a shout off 1805 when Wilmington defeated a Napoleon at Waterloo.
Yeah.
A Rothschild agent got wind of that, reported back to the Rothschild of England, but he was the head of the bank in England. He leaked it out to the banking people that Napoleon defeated the English. Overnight, they stopped coming 98%. And they bought it for pennies on the pound. Also, the Rothschilds funded both sides of the war. That's come up to the World War I. Should have never happened. British Secret Service do assassinated King Ferdinand because Germany was up and coming industrial. 20 million people just got killed for nothing. Again, the Rothschilds funded both sides of the war. Every major war was in a documentary, the Rothschilds funded.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a subtext there that if it's not completely evident, I'm not going to go there. But this is typical of Alex Jones, who takes a lot of stuff that's true. Certainly World War One, there was never any reason to have fought there. There's certainly never any reason for the United States to get into it. The fact that I always say to people, why did we enter World War One? And you can hear the crickets.
I know.
and maybe they know a little unrestricted submarine warfare, the Zimmerman note. None of that enough to actually get us into. Was Archduke Ferdinand assassinated by an agent of British intelligence? I don't know. But the key to it all, I mean, the first part, I thought people would just think would be a smart business. But he comes up with nothing and essentially talks about this conspiracy that's based on something that's pretty discredited and is not the best place in the world to find information. Or if you look at that, if that's your first introduction to some of these concepts, the next thing to do would be to go, okay, let me go read a piece of history by an historian, not by, you know, a video that goes by so fast and suggests, essentially what that suggests, that this is like secret social forces that are beyond our control that benefit without the capacity of any of us to change history. And people have all the time. All right. Thank you so much. The only two things we've really talked about tonight is this article in the New York Times where mm-hmm. it was advocated that manufacturing workers should take average real cut wages of as much as 20% to get into global balance. All right. I say let's take it out of the hides of the wealthy, not of the average person.
Speaking of average people, real quick, Roderick wrote that he said, think about probably most of the people who make the millions every year. He wonders how these people get in those positions. He doubts the average guy can get into those positions while being put there. He said that he thinks there's countless people who can competently run Chrysler GM. He says he could do a better job than the current ones.
Well, certainly when they fall on their face and they've created catastrophes of this magnitude, one wonders why were they being rewarded so richly when a lot of the signs of what was going on were seen by a number of people. Not by everybody, but there was a number of very astute economic observers that understood that this was going in a real bad direction, that there was this massive degree of wealth that was based on absolute zero. And someone said, emperor's naked. And then it all just collapses. All right, let's go to Eric. He's in Ypsilanti Township. Eric, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, guys. How's it going?
Good.
Hey, Eric.
First of all, that stupid article from the New York Times, I don't know who the author is, but he needs to get hit. Need to find another job.
There are three of them.
No. And Carrie Prejean, I'm surprised that Playboy hasn't even called up to do nudies.
Oh, they probably have.
Well, yeah. I mean, because of her book, I was just reading something that said that Carrie Prejean's book, Standing Tall, I'll even give the name of it, which already is being remaindered, probably won't pay her a dime in royalties. So she's already done 8 sex tapes, 30 nude pictures. Why not do a little?
I'll tell you why. Because Ann Coulter is helping her become a better person.
Where is she going, though? I mean, what's her next step?
Lord only knows. I've got it.
What?
Reality television.
There you go. You know, I'll tell you, Eric, we live in a land, of course, that's so mediatized that you can be famous for being famous. In a sense, that's what the Sarah Palin phenomena. I mean, this woman now, among maybe, I don't know, I guess 70% of the American people think she's unfit to be president. And the other 30% think she's absolutely great. She's on all these right-wing talk shows. She gets invited to these.
Scary.
Well, I mean.
That's scary.
As long as it's less than a third of the population.
It's still. I know.
But both of them are famous for being famous. So I don't know where Sarah Palin can go somewhere. Carrie Prejean, who's only, 22?
She's young.
Yeah. And is Larry Flint still put out? Hustler?
I don't think so. It's more the stores and the strip clubs.
Oh, well, anyways, he used to offer people like $1 million to pose nude.
Yeah.
So, hey, Eric, by the way, thank you for bringing that up. Appreciate you being on the show. $1 million. Let me see. If you stayed at today's dollars, I can't even do the math. 100,000. I mean, that would at 50 grand a year. Isn't that enough for anybody? That would last you for 20 years or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Long time. Right? If you did it right.
If I did the math.
I'm not even doing the math, so I'm just going with your numbers.
Yeah, and then she could get a real job.
You said there was no math required for this job.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. All right. Hang on the line, Scott and Ted and Josh, and we'll be back to you. We're going to take a break. 1 a.m. Got a number of, or a couple of interesting interviews. Well, let me see. I'll tell you what.
And make sure you call because we have a few open lines. Yeah. Did you already say that?
I didn't.
Okay.
James W. Loewen, remember, you know that line from that classic rock song by, why can't I think of his name? I don't know. When I look back on all the crap I learned in high school.
Oh, yeah.
Kodachrome.
Kodachrome, yeah.
Yeah. Who? Why,
isn't that
Simon Garfunkel? Paul Simon.
Paul Simon, yeah.
James W. Loewen has written a book called Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students... this doesn't make any sense. I left out a word. And get students about doing history. Whew. Wow.
You do this all the time, you know.
Yeah, I know. And then also a real interesting guy I've interviewed before. He was an unembedded reporter in Iraq, which is wandering around by himself. He's an Arab American. He's been over here. His family's been over here for 100 years, though. And he's written The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he talks about the shootings at Fort Hood. And it's a real, you think, another one of these anti-war guys. Yeah, but he's very pro-GI, which you'll see when you hear it. Okay, open lines at 313-298-WRIF. We'll also talk about the fact that the accused 9/11 mastermind is going to be facing a civilian trial in New York, and what do you think about bringing them guys to here to have the trial?
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Do you owe taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? What will you do? Your tax problem will only get worse if you don't do something about it. If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Pick up the phone and call 1-800-493-8157. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe. Remove penalties.
penalties and interest, and get the tax collector off your case. As an honest, hard-working American, you do have rights. Don't let your tax problem get worse. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Do you want a wireless laptop but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
These days, carrying a mortgage can overwhelm even the strongest person.
Don't I know that?
But there is a way to help ease your struggle, especially if you're facing foreclosure. One option may be advice from a certified foreclosure prevention specialist. It's absolutely free. Don't struggle. Learn more at www.makinghomeaffordable.gov. That's makinghomeaffordable.gov. Because foreclosure is not a foregone conclusion. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Ah, Thanksgiving. The food. The family. The zombie.
Wait a minute, what the hell?
101 WRIF presents the Thanksgiving Throwdown with Rob Zombie. Somebody's gonna wake your ass up for the food drama. The Rip has you covered. Rob Zombie, live. Friday, November 27th at the Fillmore Detroit.
Tickets available now. Get them exclusively at LiveNation.com.
Thanksgiving weekend will never be the same. The Rip. Thanksgiving Throwdown with Rob Zombie. The Fillmore Detroit. Friday, November 27th from your concert station. 101 WRIF. The Rip.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. We do have open lines, yeah. This just in, TMZ, who broke this whole thing about Miss Christian Values, Carrie Prejean, Miss California, says TMZ has learned Carrie Prejean just pulled out of a talk she was supposed to give this afternoon at the Capitol Hill Club in Washington, D.C., an exclusive club for Republicans only. An insider at the Capitol Hill Club tells TMZ Carrie canceled 5 minutes before she was supposed to speak because her camp wanted to avoid... She has a camp?
She does not deserve a camp.
To avoid a repeat of last night's Larry King Live fiasco where she almost walked off the set. This is actually a couple days old. She did walk off the set. Carrie faced a fresh wave of criticism this morning after her former hookup, her boyfriend, told us she wanted him to lie about her sex tape and tell people she was underage when she filmed it when she was really 20 years old.
Why did she want... She was underage.
She just wanted to say she was just, you know...
That she was dumb and young and...
Yeah. Yeah,
whatever.
Just a couple of years. Yeah. Along those lines, Richard writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Next step for the Miss USA, babe, I hope to God she gets into porn. I read on one of their...
She this, already is.
Yeah, on this, except no one will buy it.
Yeah, no one, well, yeah. I think some guys would buy it. Conservatives, can you imagine? Oh, yeah. She's right up their alley.
Yeah, so to speak. I read this response on the TMZ site. You know, they have reader comments.
Yeah.
And so one of them said, You know how when some of these born-agains like her say that that God planted dinosaur bones to test the faithful? In other words, how can you say the Earth is 4,400 years
old? I have never heard that.
Well, yeah, that you could say, yeah, hello, there's fossils
here.
How
do you explain that?
Yeah, how do you explain that? Say, God,
what about all this, these things in this museum here?
Yeah, no, God created those to test the faithful.
Oh, that is so ridiculous.
Well, the reader said that God made the Carrie Prejean sex tape to All right, this is pretty serious stuff. Back, I mean, for real now, not what we were just talking about. Well, that wasn't serious at all. It's just those people are such incredible hypocrites. The Obama administration announced on Friday that it's going to prosecute Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who has described himself as the mastermind of the September 11th attacks, and they're going to bring him to a Manhattan federal courtroom, a decision that has ignited a sharp political debate, but took a step towards resolving one of the most pressing terrorism detention issues. He, of course, is... The trial would be the highest security terrorism trial in history. It would be set blocks from where the hijackers for Al-Qaeda destroyed the World Trade Center, killing nearly 3,000 people. Speaking of Al-Qaeda, you know, we're in Afghanistan to what? We're there to defeat Al-Qaeda, right?
No.
You know how many Al-Qaeda operatives they think are there? I just saw this today.
How many?
100.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it.
So it's this... Ooh, oil.
So who are the other people that are fighting? Well, I think they're called Afghans. Okay. They would seek the death sentence. No decision was made about where to hold the military trial. But let's see. The administration's decision to bring five September 11th detainees onto United States soil for prosecution in the civilian legal system drew immediate fire from members of Congress as well as relatives of victims and neighbors of the federal courthouse. I mean, I actually, a friend of mine who I stay with who lives in, what's it called, Battery Park City, which is very close to, I mean, in fact, they were driven out of their apartment.
Right by the World Trade Center, yeah.
Yeah, by the fumes.
Oh, yeah, really?
When, you know, back then. They argued that Qaeda suspects did not deserve the protections afforded by the American criminal justice system, that bringing them into the United States would heighten the risk of another terrorist attack. Which I think it may very well, that civilian trials increase the risk of disclosing classified information, and that if the detainees were acquitted, they could be released into the population. Well, the last thing is a little ridiculous, but...
Yeah, please.
So, Democrat of New York, Gerald Nadler, says New York is not afraid of terrorists and what have you, but, I mean, I think there is a real problem. For one thing, it's very possible that they would ask for a change of venue. Like, can we get a fair trial? You know, no matter what kind of awful, monstrous person they are.
Yeah.
Could you talk for a second?
No matter how awful they are.
Yes, thank you.
What is your point?
That they deserve a trial. I mean, that's the American system.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose you could just, and I don't, you know what? I'll bet you a good percentage of the American people, if you said you just were going to take them out and, oop, they were shot while trying to escape, you know, that no one would have any problem with it. But this is the this is the legacy of the Bush administration. Now, I think, I mean, I would not like to be in New York City while this is going on. I think they're actually, I mean, it would, I don't know whether it would actually heighten the possibility of an attack, but it certainly is going to focus attention on these men. And this, the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is an engineer. He's a college-educated engineer. And I was reading some of the statements that he said, and he's very articulate. And he doesn't say, I'm a mass murderer and I hate everybody and I want to kill Jews and crusaders and all that. I mean, he talks about this war on Islam, and he is going to have a huge public forum for this. So what's the solution? Well, I have no idea, and that is the legacy of the Bush administration, always creating situations where you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. Let me change the pronoun. We're damned if we do, and we're damned if we don't.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we going to do? Well, I suppose you could just have old-fashioned, Justice West of the Pecos, just have the judge say, you're guilty, and hang him an hour later.
Right.
But that's not going to happen, and we do have certain international standards and responsibility for prisoners, most of which were abrogated, in fact, assaulted by the Bush administration that turned the United States into a torture state that should have been listed the way the United States used to list terrorist states. So I don't know what the hell to do. I mean, these men should be brought to trial. They're criminals that carried out this heinous mass murder.
Where do you do it?
Yeah, and how do you do it? So they're going to bring them here. And what did I write here? Yeah, fault of Bush. Should have tried. They should have been tried right away. Oh, yeah, there was one other little piece here. Yeah, this is from David Swanson, who is the co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org, which is a whole thing in itself. But, I'm sorry. He does quote in this article, but is quoted in the article. But this is from Colonel Lawrence B. Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's former chief of staff. He says, what I have learned is that as the administration, the Bush administration, authorized a harsh interrogation in April and May of 2002, well before the Justice Department had rendered any legal opinion, its principal priority for intelligence was not aimed at preempting another terrorist attack on the U.S., but discovering a smoking gun linking Iraq and Al-Qaeda. They were torturing and waterboarding, violating all sorts of international laws, federal statutes, and what have you. Bush and the rest of them are a pack of war criminals and should be tried, as well as, everyone else involved in all
of this. I wonder what's going on with Bugliosi. Was trying to make this happen, getting Bush to go to crime or
yeah.
to trial.
Bugliosi, who is a longtime prosecutor, yeah, if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, he has a documentary coming out called The Prosecution for George W. Bush for Murder. You know, I think I made another mistake there. It's the prosecution of George W. Bush for murder. Hey, you know, I expect you folks looking at this website.
Call them out.
Thousands and thousands.
You call them out on everything else.
Yeah. Send me an email when you see errors and I'll correct them. But anyway, that was why someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded like 142 times. He probably got used to it.
Wow.
I don't know if he could.
How could you?
But they were trying to get him to say, we did it for Saddam Hussein, so that, Rumsfeld and Darth Vader and the rest of them could could go in there. Yeah.
Absolutely.
They did. And look at the mess.
Yes.
Look what's happened. All right. We should go back to our phone calls because we just got a little bit of time left. Let's see. Here's Ted in Ann Arbor. Ted, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing, Peter? Hey, I have like 3 points that I want to make real quick.
Sure.
First of all, the first point is that you opened your show and you were fired up about them wanting to cut industrial workers and stuff like that in this country 20%.
Right.
How about if we increase everyone's income 35% to 40%? United States-wide. Would you guys vote for something like that? His name is Ron Paul. If he eliminates the Federal Reserve, there is no more federal tax. If there's no more federal tax, your paycheck goes up 30%.
You would
That day, it goes up 30%. So there's no arguing about that. My second.
There's no arguing about that. I love it.
I mean, you're going to finance. Listen, I've always called for a $50,000 tax deduction right off the top, and that the rest of it ought to be made by cutting the military budget in half, by stopping subsidies to agribusiness and all that. The Federal Reserve doesn't have anything to do with the income tax, and there should be income tax on the ultra wealthy in order that we don't have what we have now, this absolutely obscenely rich elite that determine policy for the rest of us.
Okay, second point, Peter.
Okay.
Second point. You're talking about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. If he was the terrorist that we want to say that he is,
yeah.
Why wouldn't he have been proud of it? Why would we have had to waterboard him 138 times in 30 days? That's torture. And on any scope of imagination, I would probably have told you I was flying the plane that hit seriously, come on.
Okay.
If he's the terrorist that we portray him to be, and
wait, I got that one. Point three.
Okay, and point three is, I remember, well, this really isn't a point, it's just a comment. I remember Julian saying about, oh, man, it was before the election even took place, that she would have to take a bath in acid if she ever caught herself voting for Ron Paul. And that was over an abortion issue.
No,
I didn't say that about him.
That wasn't about him. That was about John McCain and Sarah Palin.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it. These people remember.
I guess so. But I would never have said that about him. Right. I'm not that angry at Ron Paul, believe me.
Yeah. I mean, I thought you maybe should have had a ticket of Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul. Or,
there you go. We said that.
Or what I always said was that Dennis Kucinich...
He's been mad at me all this time about this. That's a long time.
Dennis Kucinich should have been the Democratic nominee. Although it was good. I mean, it was... Dennis Kucinich, in terms of politics, should have been the Democratic Party nominee, and Ron Paul should have been the Republican. And they could have had some principled debate about that. Here's Mitch in Walled Lake. Mitch, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys?
We're good.
Hey, I was calling about Fort Hood.
What do you think?
Well, here's what I think. I keep hearing people argue about if it was a terrorist act or not.
Yeah.
And I think everybody's missing the point, and it's a huge point that we seem to be blind to. And the point is... Benedict Arnold.
Okay.
This man was a military person, a military officer, who was collaborating with an active enemy, Al-Qaeda. He was talking with them. He was discussing with them. He was trying to join them. And then he committed an act, a heinous act in the military,
right.
An act of treason, turning his own weapons on his own people.
Right.
How come no one's mentioned that once? Not even the military. That's an act of treason. He should be tied to a post and shot.
Without trial?
With a military trial.
Oh, okay.
A military trial. He committed an act of treason against the military as a member of the military.
Well, Mitch, he very well may face the death penalty. He's going to have a trial before Universal, what is it?
UCMJ. Universal Court of Military Justice.
So he's going to be brought before that, and everybody under the sun is saying there's got to be an investigation. So I think we ought to find out a little bit more about all that, and I don't think there's going to be any doubt as to his guilt. That's pretty obvious, and very well, an execution could be in his future. All right, thank you, appreciate it. Let's see, here's Matt and Altman. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, I was just wondering if I could make a comment about the Miss California.
Yeah.
Carrie Prejean, sex star.
Well, I just wanted to say I'm a 20-year-old gay male, and I think she deserves everything that has been coming towards her just because she said it at a pageant. And I know that most of the pageants, and probably even the judges, are ran by gay men.
They are?
So it only makes sense.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
So, and even in the entertainment industry, I think there's a lot of gay males.
Well, yeah.
You know.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think she deserves it. I think it was a stupid decision.
I agree.
That's that.
Well, on the other hand, Matt, I mean, it sort of is taken for granted that her statement that she was denied the crown because of that statement ain't necessarily so. I mean, in fact, we haven't heard from the judges. You look at Miss North Carolina, and I mean, maybe it's just, I mean, I've got I'm so prejudiced against Carrie Prejean that she doesn't even look attractive to me. Right?
Right.
So I'm thinking, hey.
And I mean, she's a good-looking lady.
Who?
Carrie Prejean. I mean, and if you didn't, if she never opened her mouth and spoke, it might have helped.
Yeah.
She's still.
All right, Matt, thank you. Appreciate it. Let's see here. Here is Eric in Westland. Eric, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're good.
I want to comment on the prisoner thing, the prisoners.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think if you bring them to Michigan, I think it might bring some money in. You know, people go into the courtrooms buying tickets for it.
Charge admission.
Yeah, I think you might bring some money in. Yeah.
Well,
some admission.
Where was it up? Was it Standish where they were talking? Yeah, it was in Standish, Michigan. They were talking about opening this prison for Guantanamo inmates. Is another place. So it looks like we have lost the bid, though. They're going to open up this. Center in
Illinois,
Thompson County, Illinois, sort of like southwest or something of Chicago. And so people are saying, wait a minute, we don't want those people here. We're going to be a target for terrorists and all that. And naturally, the people around there, they said there will be thousands of jobs. I don't know where the thousands come in. But this is part of, this is the prison industrial complex. I mean, we should be living in a country where if we need to, and this is a country that's pretty crazy, so we got a lot of people that wind up getting incarcerated, which is one of the reasons that they... But anyway, that becomes this dream employment rather than probably not something that too many people would want to do. All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Scott in Westland. Scott, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. Hi, Jalene.
Hi.
Well, I guess the theme tonight is redistribution of wealth, okay? And I think that this is a problem that anybody who's, like, dimly aware of global economics, for the last 40 years, I'm only 51, so what do
I
know?
Sound younger.
But, that's...
sounds like you're... 20.
Well, I'm flattered, but okay. I don't need Al Gore to tell me that, you might say. But anyway, the point is that, well, what if you stated it positively? Okay, most people recognize this problem, and I guess I would even, if you're going to have a headline, I might call this Karl Marx's Good Intentions. Okay, you see the inequal, the inequitable distribution of wealth around the world, and you think it's unjust, and unfair. And okay, so if you're going to correct it, how are you going to do this without people getting hurt? And just for instance, I heard this statistic the other day that if you took the gross domestic product of China, even with all the growth they've had, and divided by their population, the per capita distribution is still behind countries like El Salvador and Kazakhstan.
Amazing.
So you would have to think that, okay, if you ever started to correct this problem, that if you began to flatten out these inequities, in the distribution of wealth, that wealth is going to get diluted.
Well, listen, there, what has happened, I mean, you can see in areas that are really at crisis point for human beings, say sub-Saharan Africa, what is being created as the subsistence traditional communities are destroyed by a lot of different forces, a lot of it the market forces. People are driven off their historic land. I mean, this even happened to some extent in the United States, and people came into the cities. I mean, this happened in England in the the 18th century. If you see some of these films with London, this disease-ridden, crime-ridden, something like we just saw Tom Jones on that old movie.
Oh,
that's great. That was because that the land, they had what they called the enclosures, and they essentially took land. They took the commons away from the common people, the communists, if you will, right? And the idea that we can only structure societies around the distribution of wealth, I think, is simplistic. So I may be guilty of that. But these questions can't be answered in real simple form when we're on the air. In the same way, I'm always telling people, see some video and go, oh, man, it's all the answers. That's it.
Right.
I saw it. It's the Rothschilds or whatever, or it's the New World Order. That can give you an idea. That can give you some process of beginning to investigate what's going on. What's going on is I got to get out of here. Thank you for being our last caller, Scott. I appreciate it. But be real careful of all those people that say, oh, if you took all the wealth of the wealthy from the wealthy people, we'd all get 19 cents apiece.
Right.
Yeah, so, I guess we better leave everything just as it is.
Because it's really working.
Yeah. Because you know what those people are that do that?
Yeah.
They are called conservatives.
Ooh.
Because they want to conserve everything exactly as it is. Or go back. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to thank Rob for answering the phones for us tonight.
Yeah, Rob, I want to thank you so much for coming in. Appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for listening and calling. And I'll be right back. I'll be playing these interviews I recorded earlier. What should we do first? We'll do James W. Lowen. He's an interesting guy. He's going to talk about all the crap you learned in high school.
All right.
Jalene Jordan, thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
We'll be back next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Most WRIF contests are open to legal U.S. residents at least 18 years old. Winners may win only one contest every 30 days or every 6 months for prizes worth $600 or more. Employees and their family of Greater Media Detroit, its advertising agencies, and other radio stations in the metro area may not participate. No purchase necessary. Prizes are not transferable, and rules are subject to change at any time. Complete rules are available online at WRIF.com or at the WRIF studios during regular business hours.
Everything that rocks.
Whole new pile of credit card debt. It doesn't have to be this way. We're Credit Card Relief. We help people just like you get out of debt in months instead of years and save you thousands of dollars. Call now for a free consultation. We're an attorney-driven program with an excellent reputation. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call Credit Card Relief at 1-866-290-8282. 1-866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call now. 1-866-290-8282.
Betsy, look at these sweaters. They'd look amazing on our girls.
Maybe.
Come on, what's wrong?
Suzanne, I have no business being in this store. I should not be shopping. Things are really tight. We're behind on our mortgage.
Listen, Bill and I had the same problem, and we got some really great counseling, and it was free. I'm going to email you the information.
If you even think you may be in danger of foreclosure, call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling today at 866-687-6322 or visit MortgageHelpNow.org. Public service from the NFC.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I don't think I've ever begun an interview about history without quoting these two conflicting ideas about it. Henry Ford here, the guy from Detroit who made our industrial world possible, said history is bunk. And then there was a philosopher, Santayana, who said, roughly, those that do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. You often hear that when we're talking about, say, a decision to go into a particular war or to add more troops to a war or what have you. But we can examine that and other aspects of history as well with James W. Lowen. He's the best-selling author of Lies My Teacher Told Me and Lies Across America. He's taught race relations for 20 years at the University of Vermont and gives workshops for teacher groups around the United States. He's been an expert witness in more than 50 civil rights, voting rights, and employment cases, and I want to ask him about that. He's got a brand new book out from Teachers College, Columbia University, and it's called Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. It's great to welcome back James W. Lowen. Jim, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
I'm glad to be with you.
Now, I was astounded by one thing. People are always, and I always advise people, I've got a give a couple another recommendation here. I always say read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. It sold over a million copies, and I learned that your book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, has sold a million as well. That's extraordinary, isn't it?
I'm happy.
Well, beyond happy, I mean, sure, anybody would, but this is who do you think is buying it? I mean,
well, you know, I'll tell you one group that's buying it for sure, and that is all kinds of teachers have bought Lies My Teacher Told Me, and when I speak at a place like let's say, the National Council for the Social Studies, my sessions get mobbed. So there are a lot of teachers who are trying to do better and want to go beyond just teaching the textbook. At the same time, I have to say that history is still, in some school districts, a dumping ground for coaches. And by coaches, I don't mean somebody who, you know, is a history teacher but also coaches soccer. No, I mean somebody like my history teacher in high school, Coach DeMolin, who was the basketball coach, and that's what he was first and last, and everybody understood that, and how he taught history was not meaningful to his life and didn't have anything to do with his reappointment.
That's interesting. There's an HBO program called Hung where the basketball coach is actually the history teacher as well in a Detroit area high school. Tell me about those quotes. Henry Ford saying history is bunk. Santayana saying, if you don't learn from it, you're going to repeat it. Actually, I suspect you don't agree with either of those.
No, although the Henry Ford, I'm told, if you look at it in context, what he actually said, history is, as taught in school, is more or less bunk.
Hmm.
And I think I'd go with that one.
Okay. What about the second, though? That seems to make plenty sense.
Well, the thing about the Santayana quote is that you're doomed to repeat it. There's a countervailing quote by a guy named George Friedrich Hegel, who was, of course, a very important German philosopher and important predecessor of Marx. And Hegel says, nobody ever learned anything from history. So that's kind of the opposite. And I think that there's nothing automatic about repeating history or anything like that. What we need to learn from history is causation. What causes what? And what is the, whatever we're talking about, let's say, slavery. Now, what is slavery's impact upon us today? What impact does it still have in our society? That's what we need to learn. We're not going to exactly repeat slavery, you know, if we don't learn anything about it. But we are not going to understand how it affects our society today, and it does still affect us.
Well, there's all sorts of histories coming from all different perspectives. We often see how our history textbooks are fiddled with according to the politics of a particular region or what have you, and you could maybe even expand on that. But, for instance, your book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, or Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, that could be, that people would say, oh, that's a left-wing view of history.
Well, it's certainly true for Zinn's book, and I think he would agree with that. Nobody on the left actually thinks I'm on the left.
Okay.
I will admit people on the right think I'm on the left, but nobody on the left does. And one thing that's, I think, important about both Lies My Teacher Told Me and also about this new book, Teaching What Really Happened, it has a little thing called footnotes. Now, of course, you can lie with footnotes, but it's not so easy. I mean, you know, I invite people to read Teaching What Really Happened. Let's say read what I say about the nadir of race relations. That's a chapter that most people don't know anything about. They don't even know how to pronounce nadir, and I don't blame them. They've never learned it.
Mm-hmm.
And nadir is, of course, a word, and it means low point, opposite of zenith. And so they can read my chapter on the nadir of race relations, and then they can, you know, just refer to just a couple of the footnotes at a major library or even online, some of them, and see if I've got it right. And that's a useful thing to have.
Well, it is. And usually people read to become smarter, to become more educated,
yeah,
to be able to,
yeah,
interact with the world around them. And as you said, to understand our antecedents so we can make some informed history or some informed decisions about today. But right on page one, you say that American history typically makes us stupider.
Yeah, I do.
And
I do.
And this is being the conduit for this, our teachers. So what's the matrix there for this?
Yeah, let me give you an example that happened to me, and I bet it happened to a lot of your listeners. I think I was in second grade, certainly I was around second grade, when I got taught what I call the $24 myth, which is another of the chapters in Teaching What Really Happened. You know, this is the whole story about how the Dutch allegedly bought the island of Manhattan from the Indians for $24 worth of beads.
Right, I heard it.
Yes. I asked my father if he ever learned it. He thought he did. He thought he learned it in third grade, which would put it 1911 in his case. Now, among the many, many, many problems with this story, first of all, he learned $24. Students learned $24 this past October and November, right now, which is the best time to learn disinformation about Native Americans, you know, because of Columbus Day and Thanksgiving. okay, this is the only $24 in the history of the world never to undergo inflation. Now, I say this because, for instance, my dad bought the house in Illinois that I grew up in 1937 for $5,000. He sold it after we sold it after his death for $155,000. You know, so it goes up by 31 times, yet we all are learning $24. Well, there's so many other things wrong with this story. I really shouldn't have even started with that one. Basically, it never happened. It flatly never happened.
Hmm.
So here teachers are afflicting us in mostly elementary school with this fable. And what does it do for us? Well, one of the things it does is it sure makes Native Americans look stupid.
I was going to say that it has a lot of implications.
Yeah. I mean, those little rascals, $24 won't get you a postage stamp worth of Manhattan today. And here they sold the whole island for $24. Well, they didn't, of course. Nothing like that happened. In fact, we know better if we just think of the most famous street in America, especially the last 2 years, and that most famous street is, of course, Wall Street.
Right.
And it's named for the street, the wall that the Dutch built across the top of their settlement at the lower end of Manhattan to keep out attacks from the pesky Wakaiskik Indians who lived on Manhattan. The Dutch had bought the rights to Manhattan from the Canarsies. Now, you can go to New York City today and take the subway to Canarsie.
Mm-hmm.
When you come out, you are in Brooklyn. In fact, you are in East Brooklyn at the end of the line. That's where the Canarsies lived. Why wouldn't they sell Manhattan? It wasn't theirs.
I mean, it's who got scammed, right?
They scammed the Dutch, and they got more than $24 worth of beads either. I estimate, and as far as I know, my estimate is as good as anybody's. I think it's right. I estimate that they got about $2,400 worth of five things. They got metal kettles, which they used for kettles, and which they also made all kinds of stuff out of. They got metal steel knives, steel axes, guns, and brightly colored woven woolen blankets. And meanwhile, the Dutch then, in 1644, got tired of little raids by the Wakaiskiks, and they turned around and they exterminated the Wakaiskiks, probably with help from the Canarsies, indeed, and sent the fragments of survivors reeling into what is now Westchester County on the mainland. Now, this story happened, and not only that, this story isn't so happy. You know, you might not tell it to second graders, and you certainly wouldn't tell it to them with such silly little pride, you know, because this story doesn't make the Dutch look so great. So this is kind of what we do throughout our study of history. We tell little stories that make it look like we never did nothing wrong, no how, and we remove all the real drama of what really did happen.
Well, it partly has to do with what's the function of history. If the function of history is to create a deep sense of nationalism, then we tell stories to ourselves about how wonderful we are, how the people that first came here were so brave and built a civilization out of the wilderness and all of that.
Didn't dispossess anybody. Now, the problem with that, we immediately see the problem with that as soon as we apply it to somebody else. You know, we would not agree that Germany should tell its past like that. You know, we would like Germany to face what happened in Germany in the 1930s, to face what they did to the Jews and so on. Well, then, don't we need to face, for instance, slavery? Or don't we need to face that we did take the land from the Indians at the point of a gun, usually?
Don't you think everyone knows that by now? I mean, that was not a big story, but I think...
Is it such a secret? I mean, you know, Russia did the same thing as they moved... They did the same thing as they moved east into Siberia that we did as we moved west into the Great Plains and stuff. Well, if we want them to tell the story, I think we should tell the story too.
Yeah, no, I agree. The book is Teaching What Really Happened. The author is James W. Lowen, and the subtitle is How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. And I want to get to the subtitle, particularly the last part of it, because sometimes it's okay, we're going to teach history, lock the doors, or the kids will be flying out of it, whereas I've always found history extraordinarily exciting. Well, we're coming up in a couple of weeks to Thanksgiving, and there's a bit of mythology around that, and we could probably do the whole show on it, but maybe the most things that glare out to you, James Lowen.
Well, Thanksgiving is in some ways a wonderful holiday. I like it. I like to eat the stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not too big on, never mind what I don't like. I'm not too big on sweet potatoes, but all the rest, you know,
okay.
I like the...
I'll take your sweet potatoes, but go ahead.
I'll take it in pie form, and I like the turkey, and I like all of it. I like meeting with members of my family I haven't seen, you know. It's a wonderful holiday. And yet, in two important ways, it's not so wonderful, and we need to think about that. First of all, why do we focus so much on the pilgrims? They were not, they didn't call themselves pilgrims. They weren't called that until the 1880s.
Wow.
But besides that, they're not even the first, they're not our predecessors, you know. They're not the first English-speaking people in what's now the United States. That would be in Virginia in 1607. Well, the reason we focus on the pilgrims is because they're the nicest founders of the United, of what is now the United States. They didn't attack the Indians, not exactly. They landed in Massachusetts and found place after place empty of Indians because a huge plague had swept through coastal New England in 1617, just a couple of years before they happened upon the scene. And indeed, they wind up not making a home in the wilderness. They wind up renaming the Indian village of Patuxet, and they call it Plymouth.
Hmm.
And the only guy who ever lived in Patuxet who is still alive is a guy named Squanto. And, of course, we all learn the story of Squanto. He's the Indian who spoke English, and he helped the pilgrims plant corn, and they put fish heads in the corn, and the corn grew tall, and everything is all Thanksgiving from there on. But we never learn that the reason Squanto avoided this plague, we don't even learn about the plague, is that he was in England at the time because he had been taken probably twice from North America by British and other European enslavers and sold into slavery into Spain and then made his way back to England. He had been across the Atlantic at least four times and probably six times.
Wow.
He was more traveled than any pilgrim. It's a wonderful story about Squanto. I mean, wonderful and kind of terrible at the same time, because he comes back to Patuxet, his home village, only to find that everyone there is a corpse.
Yeah.
And at this point, he throws in his lot with the pilgrims who happen on the scene a few months later. Now, there's a story, but we don't tell it.
Now, you know, in your book, Teaching What Really Happened, you don't like the idea of the word settler, yet I often put in a category white settler colonial nations, which would be us in Canada and New Zealand, South Africa, Israel,
yeah.
Australia. What's wrong with settler?
Oh, there's nothing wrong with settler, except that we usually don't use the term for the folks who are already here. We tend to think that the Indians roamed. They didn't settle.
No.
And the ironic part of it is 80% of all the Native Americans who lived in what is now the United States were agriculturalists before we got here. After we got here, we made some of them roam. The early Europeans in the East kept on burning the Indian crops and tearing down their orchards and forcing them to become nomadic. And then Thomas Jefferson and others said, oh, come on, let us teach you how to farm. Well, shoot, as the Squanto story, which is even true, implies, they taught us how to farm in the first place. So that wasn't the issue.
Well, one of the things I could imagine, I always try to anticipate questions for listeners, and some of them might be saying, yeah, so what? I mean, I may be interested, like right now, in the history of Afghanistan, because I got to make a decision whether I support President Obama's coming decision to send another 30,000 troops. What was the Soviet experience? What was the English experience? But,
yeah,
I mean, some people say, well, you know, we got our nice little holidays, Columbus Day, Thanksgiving, and you just try to put the worst possible face on it all. What purpose does all this serve?
Well, I think there's a couple. First of all, we really don't need to be, or I don't think we even want to be, stupid about the past. And we do end up stupid if we believe things like the $24 myth, you know. And second of all, I think it louses us up. It makes us more ethnocentric, you know, thinking that our way is the only way. It's our way or the highway. I believe every country in the world does this. They all sugarcoat the past, and they all believe that their society is great, you know. But I think we win the prize for ethnocentrism, and for a very good reason, and that is, let's contrast Sweden. Sweden can say to itself, well, we're the best country on earth. We have the highest standard. We have a higher standard of living than America, for instance, which they do. We have much better health care than America, which they do, et cetera. We have better statistics on longevity and on infant mortality and so on. But Sweden cannot tell itself that they are the dominant economy on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
We not only can, and that's even true, you know. Sweden cannot say we're the dominant military on the planet. We, of course, spend more on our military than all other nations combined. And also, we're the dominant culture. And this hit me upside the head a couple of Olympics ago when I saw the Chinese female divers high-fiving each other after a really good dive. Well, you know, they didn't learn that in Hunan province.
Yeah,
that's an American, in fact, that's an African-American way of congratulating each other. So it's not just Coca-Cola. You know, we really are a very dominant culture. I submit we do not need, therefore, to teach Americans to be more ethnocentric. We're ethnocentric enough. And ethnocentricity is a form of stupidity about other cultures. So let's let it go.
Let's do this. This is since this is on the back of your book, Teaching What Really Happened, I'm curious about it. You've been an expert witness in more than 50 civil rights, voting rights, and employment cases. That's amazing. What are the just probably you could talk a whole show about that, but just sort of the headlines of that.
It was a lot of fun, actually. I don't do it much anymore. I'll give you an example. The Ayers case in Mississippi. If you go to Mississippi and you look at a typical black college, you know, Mississippi has three black colleges and it has state colleges, and it has seven white state colleges historically. And, of course, historically, they were absolutely black and absolutely white. The white schools, especially the three major research universities, they call them, which are all white. That would be Ole Miss or the University of Mississippi, Mississippi State, and University of Southern Mississippi. They have the misfortune of each of them being located in a small town. A little town like Oxford, Mississippi is where Ole Miss is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the only school in the only major city in the state, Jackson, the only state school there, is Jackson State, which is a black college. So there's exactly one department of city planning in the state. Where would you expect it? Well, you would expect it in the city. You know,
sure.
It needs to be in the city. And, in fact, the city of Jackson needs its expertise. But naturally, nothing natural about it. Unnaturally, it's at Ole Miss. And the last I knew, which was some years ago, this Department of City Planning has had its students replan the Courthouse Square of Oxford 41 times, because that's the only thing they could think to do, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's a disaster. So this lawsuit says, wait a minute, these schools are separate and unequal, you know? We need to bring the Jackson State and the other two state black schools up to par with the white schools. So I was an expert witness. In that case. And I'm white, of course, but I can see inequality when it hits me upside the head, you know.
Yeah. Let's go to this, the subtitle of your book, James Loewen, Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Getting Students Excited About Doing History. I know we have a lot of teachers listening. Please explain what the first part of the subtitle means, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks.
Yeah. It's amazing, and this has incidentally nothing to do with race relations. We're just talking about the size of these books in part. To my astonishment, when I revised Lies My Teacher Told Me and went into a second edition, I read six new textbooks. I'm the only American, I think, ever to have read 18 high school history textbooks. the new ones were even longer than the old ones. The old ones average 888 pages. The new ones average 1,152 pages.
No.
They are the longest, heaviest books that you ever had in high school. I suspect every listener will remember that fact. Well, unfortunately, that has its own tyrannical hold over things then, because an awful lot of teachers think then, well, then we got to teach it. You know, we got to cover it. And by the time you're done covering all that stuff, you haven't discovered anything. You haven't uncovered anything. You've just covered it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the tyranny part.
All right. Well, let's get on to it. And I always find the conversations about history so interesting that I'm looking at the clock and we have about 3.5 minutes left. How to get students excited about doing history.
Well, I mean, for instance, a student in Detroit could, a lot of your students are immigrants. You know, you've got Latinos, you've got some Hmong people, and you've got people from Cambodia and from all kinds of different countries, people from different countries in Europe, too. And these students are kind of disadvantaged because their English isn't as good and they may be poorer and so on. But if the teacher in middle school or high school challenged them to, like, do the history, just the recent history of their family, to interview family members in the original language, let's say in Hmong, write that all down, then translate it all, write that all down, and then make up a story, coming to America or whatever, suddenly they're own history, which has been a negative, becomes a positive. It becomes useful to them. And the paper they would wind up doing would be so good that the teacher could take them all from the whole class, bind them, you know, at Kinko's or coffee shop or wherever, and stick a copy in the Detroit library or in the, you know, whatever suburb library. And 30, 50 years later, some historian coming along it with you know, who's interested in Americanization around the beginning of the 21st century would think that Santa Claus had given him or her a great gift. You know, the student has actually created an important historical source.
I see you give workshops for teachers groups around the United States, and this is the kind of suggestions that you make, I assume.
Yeah, and it gets students doing their best work, because you say to this student, maybe you got a C-minus student, not only is he or she Hmong American, I don't mean to pick on Hmong folks, but furthermore, they're not too motivated, but suddenly now, you say to him, look, this is, your paper's okay, but you got to make it really great, this is important. And they're going to buy into that. I think most students will, and they'll do the best work they've ever done in high school.
You know, in fact, this is a whole topic, but I see I have about an extra 30 seconds. When you said how to avoid the tyranny of textbooks, I thought you were going to actually mention the way that, for instance, have a textbook that's going to be used all over the country that a state like Texas or a state like Mississippi will say, well, they're not going to take it if it has too explicit a section on civil rights, for instance.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, Mississippi now mandates accurate teaching of civil rights. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So it's not as bad as you might think. But there is the tyranny of textbook boards, particularly the tyranny of the Texas adoption system. And that messes up publishers. I think that a lot of school districts, and I have some experience in Michigan. In fact, I even spoke once to the Michigan Association of School Boards. And they paid me money. I mean, they're not backward. They're not looking for the most nationalist and conservative view of our past. They want to do a good job. So I think there's room for a new 300-page paperback textbook that gets the basics right and, furthermore, doesn't always portray America as good and right all the time. And I think such a book would get adopted, and students would then own the book rather than just renting the hardbound for the same amount of money and having nothing to show for it at the end of the year. And then teachers would almost be forced to go beyond the textbook because it's just a 300-page paperback to supplement to get students doing history.
James W. Lowen's latest book is Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. He has a website. It's a little long, so if you just Google Lies My Teacher Told Me, Lies My Teacher Told Me, his site will come up. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Howard Zinn's book, history book, A People's History of the United States, which I'm always recommending, has a nice recommendation for James Lowen's book. He says, James Lowen's new book should be in the hands of every history teacher in the country. It is not only a devastating critique of how our nation's history has been taught in our schools, but is also a wonderful guide to how to the teaching of history can open up minds, excite the imagination, and educate a new generation dedicated to making this a better world. And it doesn't get much better than that, for sure. James Lowen, thanks for joining me again on the Peter Werbe Show.
I've enjoyed it.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
877-560-8877. Not available in all states. That's Debt Settlement USA. 1-877-560-8877. 1-877-560-8877.
There's something happening across America. People aren't just calling themselves DirecTV customers. They're calling themselves fans. That's because DirecTV has exclusive sports packages like NFL Sunday Ticket and free NASCAR Hot Pass. DirecTV has the most HD channels with over 130, soon to be over 200, and 50 times more movies available in 1080p. Perhaps that's why DirecTV is ranked number one in customer satisfaction among all TV service providers. So don't just watch TV. Become a huge fan. Switch to DirecTV today. Call 1-888-359-5566. There's no equipment to buy and no startup costs. Packages start at just $29.99 a month. Call 1-888-359-5566. That's 1-888-359-5566.
Sports subscriptions sold separately. New customers only on approved credit. Credit card required except Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. Hardware lease and programming commitment required and available separately. Other conditions apply. Call for details. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging lime scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, which cost you up to 25% more. That's an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy. With HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system, guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com.
I guess we got caught up in the crazy housing boom.
We had been in the house so long, we didn't want to lose it.
What these people share is that they all got in trouble with their mortgages, and they all called a certified housing counselor for help.
Our housing counselor looked at our paperwork, and she knew something was wrong.
She understood what needed to be done, and she helped me work it out with the bank. This is a free service. Call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling now. Call 1-866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org.
Did I win? I won?
Thursday.
Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday. Exclusively from your walk right in free station. 101.
Who are you?
WRIM.
Sign up to donate blood with 101WRIF and the American Red Cross over Thanksgiving weekend. If you make and keep your appointment, you'll get your choice of Detroit Pistons tickets or a Dearborn brand gift certificate. Other treats include a chance at a $1,000 shopping spree. Get all the details now at WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby with you. This is being recorded on Veterans Day 2009, and the extra tragedy, of course, is that is about what happened at Fort Hood the other day. But still, the endless wars the United States has taken part in has produced an institution of fallen veterans, and as we speak, President Obama is giving tribute to them in Washington, D.C. But what happened at Fort Hood suggests many things. And joining me is Dar Jamail. He is the author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refused to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's published by Haymarket Books. I previously interviewed him about his first book, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. He's also just written a piece called Mass Shooting Indicates Breakdown of Military. That's published at truthout.org. Dar Jamail joins me from Ventura, California. Jamail, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be with you again.
What does this mean? Mass shooting indicates breakdown of military. We had a breakdown of the military at the end of the Vietnam War. There was real concern that not only would the U.S. lose the war, but it would actually lose the military to drugs and mutiny and what have you. It doesn't look like we're at any point like that now.
That's correct. It's a different kind of breakdown. We don't, you're exactly right, we don't have a massive organized GI resistance movement that's tied in with a civil rights movement and a movement powerful enough to help end a war. Nothing even beginning to approach that. But we have a different kind of breakdown, and it's one that a lot of us have been writing about and investigating and talking and warning about for a couple of years now, and many people listening may be familiar with at least some of this, but we have a military that's very stretched thin. It's been at a breaking point for several years now because of both of these ongoing occupations. It's a military that doesn't have enough people to keep troops on the ground and keep them fresh and keep them provided with services that they need, anywhere from proper body armor and things overseas to even more importantly, or just as importantly, I'm sorry, just as importantly, psychological treatment, physical treatment when they get home, and especially when they get discharged from the military. I mean, I've been talking to people who've been redeployed 4 times, 5 times, 6 times. I've talked to someone who's been over in Iraq 7 times.
Oh.
And then not enough time in between deployments, not enough treatment for their PTSD when they're still in uniform, and then certainly not when they get out. I mean, for example, when someone discharges and then they have a valid discharge and they're entitled to VA benefits for the rest of their life, they have to wait an average of 6 months to get into their first VA appointment. These are all statistics according to the VA. And then if they appeal, if they file for a disability claim and that's denied by the VA and they want to appeal that claim, they're going to be waiting on average 4.5 years to get an answer. So all of these are contributing to big, deep problems within the military.
Yeah, the tributes, the rhetorical tributes, which are good and deserved, people recognize publicly the sacrifices that have been made over the generations. But when it comes down to it, a man or woman coming out of Iraq or Afghanistan needs a little less rhetoric and a lot more direct service.
Exactly. We have a situation where we are dangerously repeating what we saw in Vietnam. I mean, the official U.S. death count in Vietnam was 58,000, more than 3 times that number. More than 170,000 Vietnam veterans have committed suicide in the wake of that war and continue to this day.
Well let me interrupt you. I mean, I'm not aware of that statistic. Say that again and tell me the source. And I mean, this 150,000 suicide. That's amazing. Please flesh that out some.
Yeah, it's actually more than 170,000 suicides just from Vietnam. It's statistics gathered from, and these are specifically just Vietnam veterans. So when that war ended, from that day until present time, more than just over 170,000 Vietnam veterans have committed suicide. And these are statistics gathered from sources like the Veterans Administration and other suicide prevention groups that work directly with Vietnam veterans. Even according to the VA, right now, 18 veterans from all wars, so including Iraq and Afghanistan, Vietnam, Korea, all wars, 18 veterans every single day commit suicide in this country. Nearly one out of every three homeless people you'll see on the streets of this country is a veteran of some war. According to the VA, 1,000 veterans technically under the auspices of VA care every single month are trying to kill themselves. At Fort Hood alone, we've seen more than 70 suicides at that base alone just in this year. In fact, I spoke with someone there 2 mornings ago, and the night before they had been attending to a friend, another soldier at Fort Hood, who had attempted suicide and thankfully not succeeded. It is a crisis, and it's being perpetuated by people being redeployed, not enough time in between deployments, not getting the care they need. If we remember back to this past May, I'm going on a little bit of a tangent here, but this is related.
Sure.
Last May in Baghdad, a soldier at the end of his third deployment walked into a PTSD clinic and gunned down and killed 5 other American soldiers. In the wake of that tragedy, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and Joint Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Admiral Mullen both spoke directly to the fact that we need more time in between deployments. We can't keep sending people overseas on this very, very fast treadmill. We need to increase the services they need, their psychological care and support, et cetera, all absolutely correct, all great things to say. They did not follow through with any of these actions. Yes, the Obama administration has made a large increase in the amount of VA funding, but it's not nearly enough to give people the support they need. People people in the military now that are being asked really to go beyond, far above the call of duty by doing these repeated deployments. People are being stop lost. The government's not honoring the real end of their contracts and having additional tours tacked on. So it really is a crisis situation.
Dr. Mayle, tell us, though, when we've heard these statistics about suicides, but it actually has to be posed against what would be the figures for civilians and for that age group and what have you. I mean, has there been that sort of metrics done?
There have, and we find even more disparity with that. In fact, traditionally, the military has had a much, much, much lower rate of suicides than the civilian population for a couple of main reasons. One, they're generally a lower age group, healthier, living in a fairly tightly controlled environment, exercising every day, this kind of thing. So traditionally, the military has almost always had a significantly lower suicide rate than the civilian population. Now it's just about right on par. The civilian population rate is generally higher, namely because, older folks, a lot of folks giving up on life, killing themselves, people with diseases, this kind of thing. So there's numerous reasons why the civilian rate has always traditionally been higher, and it makes a lot of sense. So the fact that now the military rate is just about right on par with the civilian rate is actually alarming.
Now, your first book for Haymarket Books, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. In fact, maybe you could even briefly tell us that story, how you just decided to go over to Iraq and see for yourself what was going on. I mean, we were stuck with the embedded journalists who didn't have enough critical distance, according to many of us. And have you been to Afghanistan?
I have not been to Afghanistan. I decided to go into Iraq in the desperate need to try to get factual information out to people back here, because, of course, during the lead-up to the war, most people in the country believed it had something to do with 9/11 and there were weapons of mass destruction and all of this. And, clearly now, especially 6 years later, 6 years into that occupation, everyone, the vast majority of Americans, now well over 70%, are opposed to that war, and rightly so. It was all based on lies, and we all know this, but now I've basically turned my attention, instead of reporting from the ground in Iraq and focusing on Iraqi's perspective largely, I've really kind of gone unembedded into the military, and I've been talking with people they are the ones having to carry out these orders. They are the ones having to go serve these repeated deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're coming back and they're talking about atrocious things that they're seeing, anything from, what it's like to actually witness a suicide bombing, to sometimes killing civilians themselves, to seeing their buddies blown up, and then coming back home and actually, on the one hand, they're being told, if you have psychological problems and you think you might have PTSD, please come approach us and talk to us so we can help you. On another hand, they're actually ridiculed by their units, ridiculed by their commanders oftentimes, and when they do go to try to get these services, as I said before, they're either not available or they have to wait an inordinate amount of time. I mean, how do you wait to go see a counselor for 6 months when you have severe PTSD after doing a couple of tours? You're not sleeping at night. You're having nightmares. You're having flashbacks. You're grinding your teeth. All you can feel is rage. And then, now we start to get a little bit more full idea of why there are so many suicides.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little about what happened at Fort Hood. You wrote, "Mass shooting indicates breakdown of military." I was talking to an African-American friend of mine, and he said, when this first happened, his first words were, "I hope that it was a white Christian guy that did it." Fearful that it would either be someone with a Muslim name or that it would be an African-American who did it. Well, half his fear came true. And your name, Dar Jamail, is all of a sudden that throws a different perspective on all this. People suddenly again are ramping up the prejudices of people. Do you find any when you approach? In fact, maybe you could tell just a little of your ethnic history as well, or background.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, you know, people hear my name and immediately I get profiled. At least not always. I mean, it's actually fairly uncommon. But I actually love to get profiled because if anyone saw me, I would certainly not stand out in a crowd as someone that didn't look like the average American, whatever that might look like. But I have an Arabic name because I'm fourth generation, about a quarter Lebanese on my father's side. And another nice wrinkle to this is many people over here don't understand that there's a very large Christian population in Lebanon, and so I was raised Christian, raised Catholic, as were my descendants over in Lebanon, my ancestors, and then I'm German Irish on my mom's side, so my middle name's Kelly. So that kind of blows apart some of the profiles when people try to link me to Al Qaeda or something like this. Born and raised in Houston, Texas, and I went to school at Texas A&M University, and here we are. But yeah, this is a very, very big problem of profiling and lobbing people into groups. And I, too, was very distressed right when I saw that the person that carried this out was a Muslim of and an Arab American. And I knew that the rhetoric that we're seeing now on a daily basis, the anti-Islamic rhetoric, the fear-mongering would come and it would be very ugly. I mean, for example, when Timothy McVeigh, a 91 Gulf War veteran, did this catastrophic bombing at the Oklahoma City Federal Building, killed over 100 people. We didn't hear calls to banish all Christians from the military and keep them separated and declare a war on Christianity. Last September a year ago at Fort Hood, there was another shooting, but this one was carried out by a white male Christian. We didn't hear at that time people calling to banish all Christians from the U.S. military. And if you think these are absurd examples, I'm simply applying the same logic to those instances that these people are applying to this one. And the reality is that, you know, everyone involved in these types of incidents, you know, the one last September, Timothy McVeigh, Major Hassan, they're all clearly extremely disturbed people. They're all atrocious situations and should be condemned to the highest level possible, of course. But at the end of the day, these are all individual acts. And even the FBI has said that Major Hassan was acting alone, was not acting in concert with any other group. This was clearly a very, very, very disturbed, troubled, sick person that needed some kind of help, didn't get it, didn't reach out for it, and took matters into his own hands and carried out this atrocity. So it's very troublesome, and it's funny, too, to see that even high-ranking people in the military brass are coming on programs and being very even-handed about it and saying, look, no, they're basically saying what I've said, is that we don't want to single out a religion or an ethnicity. This is a personnel problem, and it needs to be addressed on an individual basis.
I know you're proud both of your name and of your ancestry. In fact, your website is dahr.org, D-A-H-R, D-A-H-R.org. Is there any time you thought that if you could have approached somebody and said, hi, I'm John Smith, and I'm doing an article or a book or trying to find out, that it would have worked better? Or is there times when being Dar Jamail worked better for you and John Smith would have been a detriment, like when you were in Iraq?
Well, yeah, it has gone both ways. When I was in Iraq, certainly being Dar Jamail helped. Having an Arabic name did probably break the ice at least a little bit when people, we would approach people and ask if we could talk to them and interview them, we being me and my Iraqi interpreter, because I don't speak hardly any Arabic. And then on the other hand, when I came back home and, you know, getting on bigger radio programs or even national programs, maybe if I did have a name like John Smith, it could have helped. But, you know, that's just not who I am.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw this movie. It's just been released, and I don't really recommend it. But I actually, before we even set this up, I thought about you. It was called Men Who Stare at Goats. It's this George Clooney movie about, it's set in Iraq, and it's about this unembedded journalist that goes... that winds up with this absolutely crazy character, George Clooney, and enters Iraq on his own. I don't know if you've seen it. I didn't like the movie, but I just the setting and the idea of it may be appealing to you.
Well, I know of the book and I've read some of the book. It's a very compelling book, and it's funny that the movie, I haven't seen the movie. I probably will go see it. But it's interesting, the spin on the movie, because the book is actually very deadly serious and a deep investigation at the lengths the military goes to try to explore these kind of topics. I mean, the movie is actually based on a factual book.
Now, the movie's pretty much a comedy. I mean,
okay.
If you can imagine I guess MASH. I mean, talk about dark comedies.
Sure. Anyway,
let's get back to the subject at hand. My guest on the Peter Werby Show is Dar Jamail. His latest book for Haymarket Books is The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. I would think that that'd be a pretty short book.
Huh? Well, you know, I never even knew that there would be a topic here to write a news story about, let alone an entire book, until about 2 years ago. I ran into a soldier here in the U.S., a guy who was still active duty. I was up at nearby Fort Drum in upstate New York. This guy, Phil Aliff, and he started talking to me about his time in Iraq and said morale was extremely low, and we took it to doing what we called search and avoid missions, a play on search and destroy. He said we were so bummed out. We didn't want to be there. There was no clearly defined mission, and we thought it was senseless to keep doing patrols when we were basically just driving around waiting to get blown up. So we decided to stop. So we decided to take our Humvees to the end of our patrol route, park them in a big, nice, open field, call in every hour and tell the base we're searching the field for weapons caches, do that for the length of our patrol, and then head back in. And I said, oh, my God, I've never heard of this. How often were you doing this? He said, we were doing it just about every other day. And then I kind of took it, I wrote down some notes and then just kind of sat on it. I didn't think that there would be enough to do any kind of a story on one person's experience doing this. But then the next day, I met a guy named Eli Wright. Very similar story, different part of Iraq, different time of the occupation. So I started to poke around a bit, and I met more and more veterans and started hearing even more stories of all kinds of varied resistance that's happening in the military. And it turned out there's enough to write a book, and I only have actually one chapter on folks doing the things I just mentioned in Iraq and other variations and other different types of resistance like that. But I have chapters on different kinds of resistance in the military, things about how women, for example, are resisting rape and sexual assault, which are so rampant in the military, especially for women. According to the VA, 1 in 3 women in the military will be raped or sexually assaulted before the end of their contract. And so women are banding together and forming groups and doing what they can to fight back against that. Lots of other different types of resistance, soldiers who are blogging, writing books about their experiences, using art as resistance, and doing what they can to try to get more factual information out to people in this country about what's actually happening in these wars.
I have to suspect that part of the interest you have in it is that you, like I do, oppose both these wars, and this is another indicator of what a misadventure it is. Yet the old adage for the military, something I've never served in, ours is not to wonder why, ours is just to do or die. And this breaks that. I mean, so when you have soldiers who refuse to fight, the argument goes, then he leaves his comrades in arms to suffer the results of the policies for that are good or bad that have been made by the upper brass and the politicians.
Right, and the thing is the military is based so much on certain myths, and, you know, the one you just shared, and I've heard that so many times, even from the soldiers themselves, ours is but to do or die, and even that is false, and even that goes, that is a true adage, but that goes against even the oath that soldiers swear to support and defend the U.S. Constitution by following lawful orders. So that inherently in their oath that they swear as a soldier, it demands that they be discerning about whether or not the orders they're given are lawful or not, because there's these little things called the Geneva Conventions that if you go to war and you don't follow international law, you can be tried for war crimes. This is what was set up in the wake of World War II, and we had the Nuremberg Trials and the Nuremberg Principles, where these were greatly expanded at the time, the GCs where that was, because of what happened with Hitler's regime. And so the U.S. is, of course, a signatory of these, and then by definition of the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, Article 6, Paragraph 2, we have to follow those rules, those laws as well. Even though we didn't write them, if we signed on to that, we have to adhere to them. Thus, a soldier that swears to uphold, to support and defend the Constitution by following lawful orders, they need to be very careful about what orders they follow. And for example, if they're going to deploy to an occupation, to a war zone that is breaking the Geneva Conventions, then they are not following their oath. And so this is what a lot of these soldiers are starting to realize, that I have to follow lawful orders, and by taking part in this totally failed U.S. foreign policy right now, I'm not doing that. And that is another big reason why the military is in a state of breakdown.
Well, I mean, making the military argument, if you have individuals deciding that, it would be chaos, essentially. Whenever you have an occupying force, anything that's not in frontal warfare, one army massed against another, like in World War II, whenever you have partisans, whenever you have a country occupying another area, and you have civilians fighting against the occupying force as insurgents or militants or whatever label you want to call them. Sometimes they're called freedom fighters. If you're going to watch the remake of Red Dawn that's being made here in Detroit, that's when the civilian populations really start getting chewed. It's not like one guy with a helmet against another guy with a helmet. It's as they used to say in Vietnam, the Mama San who smiled at you might have a grenade under her dress, and probably the majority of time she did not. Probably the overwhelming majority of times she did, but sometimes they did. So it almost goes with the territory if you're going to be fighting insurgents that are among civilians.
It is, and this is another, the military, one thing I've learned, well, a lot of things I've learned by investigating the military when I was working on this book, it is ripe with contradictions. I mean, Catch-22 was written for good reason. You know, on one hand, the military indoctrinates people in with that, mantra of, I just got to follow orders, I sign on the dotted line, I don't get to choose, anything. I'm not allowed to think. I'm just supposed to charge forward when I'm told to charge forward and stop when they say to stop. And that's it. And then at the same time, in the oath that soldiers swear the way that they're sworn in, it requires them to think and it requires them to discern. You know, if you're in Afghanistan and your commander says, race into that house and kill all those women and children, are you supposed to just do that because you're trained to follow orders and not question? Probably, any thinking human being, soldier or otherwise, would say, you know what, that just doesn't seem quite right. At the very least, you're going to question your soldier and say, your sergeant, and say why, and that's what's supposed to happen, and that is what is inherent right there in black and white in the oath that they swear. And that is why, for example, Lieutenant Aaron Watada of the U.S. Army back in summer 2006 publicly refused a combat deployment to Iraq, and has since, he was court-martialed, the judge blew the trial, and he has since been released from the military and didn't spend a day in jail or a day in Iraq by rightly and publicly refusing this illegal order.
You know, we have just about 30 seconds left, and as we talk here and record this on Veterans Day, President Obama, the man who got elected on the program of change, is about to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan. What's your thoughts?
I think it's lunacy. I think it is a failed policy. You have, Russian leaders coming out and former Russian leaders coming out and saying, don't do it. We did it. Please learn from our mistakes. The majority of people in Afghanistan are opposed to this happening. And right now, the majority of the people in this country are, according to the latest polls. So I think Obama is about to make the greatest mistake of his entire political career.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dar Jamail is the author of a new book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's published by Haymarket Books. You can go to his website, dahr.org. It's dahr.org. And I'll also have a link on my website, peterwerbe.com. And normally I don't do this, but I'm curious, you vets that are listening, what do you think about all this? You can write to me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Dar Jamail, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIN. Everything that rocks.
Each year, millions of baseball fans cheer for the home team. And it takes everyone playing as a team to get the win.
Home run is running third.
Listen, baseball's all about teamwork. Major League ballplayers know to be safe at home, they have to work together. As a fan, teamwork means being responsible and getting your friends and family home safely to and from the ballpark. So always wear your safety belt and use a sober-designated driver. Find out how you can win tickets to the World Series or a trip to the All-Star Game by visiting the designated driver booth at a Major League ballpark, because responsibility has its rewards.
A message from Team Coalition.
Thanksgiving Throwdown with Rob Zombie. Friday, November 27th at the Fillmore Detroit.
Get all the details at WRIF.com.
101 WRIF. The Riff.
A Monday warrior, mean stride. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean pride. We'll be right back.
has an exciting life of its own.
Famous 101 WRIF, WRIF HD1 Detroit, and WRIF.com.
Perfectly balanced, low drag, minimal torque.
The Rare.